I assume some members of the media. Dames en heren. Back on our work. Can we quickly do introductions just because we are getting new people from time to time, although I think I know all of them, almost, most if not all. But from my side, my name is Jabu Mahlangu, chair of the committee, and can I request Madam T to continue, and colleagues.
Member of the committee. Good morning, everyone. My name is Marian Shin.
Cameron McKenzie, committee member.
Robert Ward, PMG.
Sorry, Jane Wilkes. That's also PMG, but we've got a confusion.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. Tanya Abraham from CETA.
Morning, Chair, Honourable Members. Carmenita Dudley, Telcom.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Pindile Jani from Telcom, the Mother Network.
Morning, Chairperson, Honourable Members. Denzel Bowman, Liquid Telecom.
Good morning. My name is Nalo Kungubela. I'm with Econex.
Good morning, Chair and everybody. Johan Smith, Telkom.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. Lisa Zwabi from Telkom.
Morning, Chair. Colin Mashida, Department of Communications.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Yolandi van Aswegen with the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Good morning, everyone. It's Botlenyana Mogele from ICASA.
Morning, Chair. I'm Sihle Manenza from ICASA.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Joshua Mwela from Celsi.
I'm Temba Piero from Celsi.
Good morning, Graham McKinnon from Celsi.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Cynthia Lesufu from Department of Telecommunication and Postal Services.
Morning, my name is Mamesa Masamula from DTPS.
Good morning, I'm Robert Nkuna, DTPS.
Morning, Honourable Chair and Members, colleagues, Alf Wilt, DTPS. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, my name is Mbombo Maleka from Parliament.
Morning, Chair, panel members, Karen Edmondson, Regulatory Consultant to CELSI.
Good morning, my name is Harish Kasipsot from CELSI.
You have others somewhere there. Please, if you stand up and just introduce, I know, a bit of a shouting, but it's allowed. Back. Sit here. Just come and occupy these seats. At the back. Can all those DTPSs come here? Okay. There are seats here. We want to see all of you, if we are able to accommodate you. I want to tender the apology of the minister, she always does send an apology, so she's not going to be with us. But secondly, you would remember that on Tuesday, we did indicate that we are going to request Madam Julie not to attend so that she can go rest And she's got a very bad tendency that if she has to rest, she keeps a TV on to check what's happening in Parliament, and then she starts communicating with an SMS. But we requested her to not to attend so that she rests. Actually, just as courtesy, we took her out for dinner last night just to wish her well and pray with her and hope that she undergoes that huge operation and go over it. So she's got our prayers and our support. Colleagues, I did indicate the other day that we will on Thursday morning start with some reflections, if there are any. I know we've been asking questions to people, but we've never really had. So if members would be kind enough, 2 minutes, just on brief reflections. I think I've been doing the reflections as chair from time to time, saying, for instance, having listened to the presentation and the call for ourselves not to rush through the process, a request for thorough engagements on a range of issues, I went on to say, having listened to the presentation, having seen the magnitude of the work in front of us, it is become very clear that we are not going to conclude this process during this parliament, and therefore the work will have to go to the next parliament. All we will do is really to try and see how far we could put everything together and hand over to the House Chair with certain requests, among them that the sixth parliament should look at these issues, but also to an extent that we requested the department to convene all the players and see how they could workshop certain aspects. Spectrum come in as one of those areas that requires zooming down. The whole issue of the Rapid Deployment Committee, its role, issues of ICASA powers being tampered with, affecting the independence, taking powers by the minister, issues that affect the municipal powers, encroaching into that space, and the aspect of land. And I mean, I think we already have said some of those things need to be workshopped. So we have a very beautiful window ahead of us from now until after elections, which is May next year or so. And as part of the inductions of new members, that they should actually be walked through by scholars like Professor Gilward. I mean, ICASA has also offered to expose us to some other knowledgeable people. I mean, everyone that I've met, actually met, everyone has made an offer to say, we think, you know, this kind of an exposure for the new committee will benefit them so that they are able to take this bill forward, because you definitely need knowledgeable people to deal with the matter. So I'm just skating through a few things that we've already identified. And we also have then said, because we will be dealing with the big girls and boys, although we have had some bigger ones, but the known big, top foot, big four, we are hoping that as they do their presentations, they will deal with this crucial matter of transformation of the industry. Because that's the essence of the one, which is becoming everybody's, everyone wants to harp on it. It's constitutional, it's anti-competitive, it's affecting the competition in the infrastructure, it's affecting Others thought it's a state-owned enterprise. Others feel it must be. Others feel no, it must be pure business. Others had committed to take a particular percentage of it. And I mean, I'm saying when we get the presenters today, especially from Telkom, Cell C, MTN and Vodacom, or those that will be presenting today, tomorrow, I hope that they could assist the process. If there are those that are uncomfortable with WARN, they must actually say how do they then ensure that we achieve the objectives of the bill without following that route if needs be. Put something on the table that will speak to this dire need for participation. I mean, ISPA, WEPA, Makaya, and other people that have made the presentation have been making an outcry and say, we want to participate. Indeed, the ECT landscape is the future of the world. And therefore, leaving important players out is not in the best interest of our country, but it's never in the best interest of the world. So how do we help achieve this objective of transformation of the industry? I mean, from the point of view of those that will be coming to present. But like I said, I would request members to have reflections briefly. Madam Shin, are you ready to come in? And Baba Mackenzie, Mam Dongeni, and Mam Mutote, just in brief, just you're the floor, madam.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your excellent chairmanship of this process. We have, as the outgoing committee in the sector, an onerous obligation to put forward a plan for our successors on how we think, from gathered from the input from all the people that we've heard this week, I'm speaking now already for Friday afternoon, that we owe them our most concentrated focus on producing a report or whatever it is that we produce at the end of this that actually guides our successors and the entities involved in this process to actually commit to working in what is the best interest of the end user. We actually legislate for the ICT users of the country, and we should not forget that should be our focus. Without them, the industry cannot fly, because those are the people that we need to empower through this. We need to make sure that everyone in the country has robust, sustainable, reliable, cost-efficient, effective, whatever you want, affordable internet access so that they can become citizens of the world. That's everybody. So we need to make sure that that is our focus, and we actually need to gather the best brains in the industry together to guide us and inform us on whatever we suggest to our successors to take this process forward in the next parliament.
Madam Shin, Baba Mackenzie.
Thank you, Chair. Not much I can add to that. I think what's become clear over these hearings, which have been very interesting, is that, and this is something that's just sort of, as I wake up in the morning, this idea occurs to me, this sector, this telecommunications sector, is not the end. It's not the end goal. It is the means to an end. The end must be job creation. The end must be economic growth. The end must be a highly efficient, highly effective, and cost-effective telecommunications service and sector. That must be the end. And it seems that many presenters here are focusing on the means as the end. So, you know, my notion would be that in the 4.5 years that we've sat here as a committee, have we enabled the telecommunications sector to move forward? Have we pushed them forward, given their impact on economic growth? Or have we in fact delayed the progress of telecommunications in this country? And I would argue that the latter applies, Chairperson. And as a committee, this committee and the committee to come in the next parliament should be seized with the best way to drive the sector forward as an enabler for economic growth and job creation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Babu Mackenzie. Mam Sotesi.
Yeah, Chairperson, I think you said it in your opening remarks that our main objective here is about transformation. And we need the support and cooperation of the big players to ensure that small players do not remain small, but gradually they grow so that we make sense of the transformation policy. We do not have any intention of tampering with your profits, but you know, there's a saying by James Maxwell to say great men show their greatness by how they treat little men. So we know this game could be very vicious, but we'd like to appeal for your support that you are public representative, and we are not, you know, in a game of enriching others at the expense of others, but we know that the purpose of one being in a business is to make profit, but let it not be at the expense of others, and we need your cooperation. Just want to emphasize that we want to make sure that small businesses, they do grow, and I think we are one on that. Thank you.
Mam Dongene, are you, you've passed it over.
I'm covered, Chair, by comrades, by Honourable Joseph. Sorry to say comrade, by Honourable. But I'm all with you, all with yours. At the same time, we are all in this journey. If we can work together, we can do more. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, colleagues. Indeed, the sentiments of the committee members is welcomed.
Just 1 point that you have alluded to, that we are not, you know, experts in this field. We rely on other people to be honest with us and share with us, you know, their knowledge to make sure that there's progress in this business that we're on. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, madam. Okay, we are now this presentation has become too big. Mvetu, ngasebenzi kanjalo ntathetswala to twale andile and Councillor Peladi Kwangwa. Colleagues, you would remember that when I did the announcement, I think it was on Monday or Tuesday, I did say there are two presenters that I have allowed to come in. I don't know them, but I saw their requests and allow them to come in. One, because the first one has to do or was going to do a presentation that deals with the BBBE, that BBBE, and the other one is an economic analyst from the University UCT. In other words, it's going to be the very first presenter and the last presenter are the two that I have brought in. But they should not take all the time we have, you see, because they were out of space, so ngabazama ngabafaka, so ngatangibanikele isandla bathathe ingalo yonke. I hope that you will stick within the timeline, but welcome. You are on the floor.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Once again, thanks for the opportunity to afford the Council the opportunity to contribute to this process. I also want to note members of the House, members of the Portfolio Committee, Deputy Chairperson Gwangwa, the DG Nkuna, Acting DDG, Mamizi, and other colleagues in the industry. My name is Rale Tlhokgonolo A. Tlhwaele Andile. I'm with the Deputy Chairperson, Councillor Pilar D. Gwangwa. What we are going to do is basically take you through three areas. The latter one is the most important. We've categorized our presentation in terms of Section A, B, and C, just as a way of introduction, introducing the Council, and then we are just going to do a high level, and this is where we're going to move very fast in terms of the ECA bill and the amended BBBE ICT sector code. And then lastly, our submission to this process. So what we define as our success is mandated from the BBBE Act of 2013. So essentially, there is a reference in the bill of the BBBE ICT sector code. So we are here to empower the House to understand what is that BBBE ICT sector code and who develops that BBBE ICT sector code and how does it work. So this is the Council that is mandated in terms of the BBBE Act to develop the code, communicate the code, provide guidance to the beneficiaries, to all the stakeholders that are supposed to engage with the code, and also amend the code as and when required and review it. We are mandated by the BBBE Act to then report progress to our line minister, which is now Honorable Minister Stella Ndabeni Abrahams. We are mandated by the Act to also report to the DTI, to the BEE Commissioner, to the Advisory Council, the Presidential Advisory Council. We are also mandated by the Act to then share the progress and status reports to this House and other stakeholders in the industry. So that's what the Act sets us to do. What is the composition of the Council? The Council is composed by five categories of stakeholders, industry players from the electronics, broadcasters, IT services, and telecoms industry. We also have labor representatives, youth, and women, particularly women in ICT. We also have ICASA in the Council, the Department of Communications, and the Department of Telecommunication, Postal, and Services. And the last stakeholder is the community in the Council. Just last, in terms of the Council, how we function, we are an oversight body that is mandated to ensure that the BBBE Act is implemented in the sector. We have an EXCO that is chaired by the Deputy Chairperson. The EXCO coordinates all the work of the Council and is basically participated by all the chairpersons of the subcommittees. We structured the subcommittees in terms of the requirements of the Act. The Act says we must communicate the code, so we've got a Communications and Stakeholders Engagement Committee, Guidance and Monitoring Committee, Amendment Review, Strategy, Governance, Risk Funding Committee. In terms of how does then the BBBE ICT sector code talks to the ECA bill, from where the Council sits, the BBBE Act is the basically when it's an enabler for transformation in the economy. So our code is actually published in terms of Section 9(1) of the BBBE Act. What essentially means in the ICT sector, when you read the BBBE Act, when it comes to Section 9(1), our BBBE code that is referred in the ECA bill will then replace the generic code of the DTI. So in other words, when you read the bill where it says the BBBE ICT sector code, it basically talks to the code that has been issued in terms of the BBBE Act of 2013. the objectives of the Act are basically the first one, to promote economic transformation. So as a council, we have to make sure that the code that is now aligned to the bill speaks to issues around economic transformation, enabling meaningful participation of black people in the economy. The second part is how does the code assist in the change and substantial change in the racial composition of ownership and management structure. So the bill currently, it talking to the code, is designed to achieve these objectives. Thirdly, how does the code, to the extent that it allows communities, workers, cooperatives to participate in the economy. You'll see in the code, we talk to these objectives that are in the BBBE Act. And we are here to say the code that is in the bill seeks to increase the extent to which black women-owned and managed enterprises are given access to skills, economic activities, and infrastructure. And also, we are saying that the bill, in its reference to the ICT sector code, promotes investments into broad-based black economic participation by black people, empowers rural and local communities, promote access to finance for startups. So just by referencing some of the amendments that have been proposed, the bill will enable these to happen. And then lastly, increase effective economic participation by black-owned and managed enterprises. Without the bill referring to the code, these objectives will not be realized. The BBBE Act is the only act that allows that, and the code is the tool that allows those things to happen. And the bill as it stands now, and I will hand over later to Councillor Piladi, who then assert our submission to the House in terms of affirming what the status of the bill. Now, in terms of the interpretation of the code, it's very important, of course, first, that in terms of transformation in the country, the BBBE Act objectives and purpose supersedes everything. So in other words, when we talk about transformation, those are key. Secondly, of course, everything we do must comply with the Constitution. Section 3 of the Act also talks to an important part, to say this process is almost late, Chairperson. In terms of the BBBE Act, insofar as transformation, in terms of the BBBE Act, and this is Section 3, and I just read it, it says, in the event of any conflict between the BBBE Act and any other law in force immediately prior to the date of commencement of the BBBE Act prevails, if the conflict especially relates to the matter dealt with this Act. In other words, this Act, the BBBE Act, prevails. So what this means is that this process is late, in a sense that when the BBBE Act was passed by the House, it gave basically a year to say this process must happen. And then it says if this process did not happen, this is what is referred to as a trumping clause. So effectively, the regulator or any other entities that are applying any law that seeks to promote transformation must apply the BBBE Act. It's in that context, Chairperson, that this process seeks to clarify and make sure that all those housekeepings are aligned in terms of the legislation. The second part is the issue of Section 10. This talks to what is the status of the code that we're talking about. What is the status? So Section 10 of the BBBE Act 2013 states that every organ of state and public entity must apply any relevant code of good practice issued in terms of this Act, which is the BBBE Act. So we are here to say, Chairperson, that the bill as proposed insofar as transformation is aligned to the BBBE Act. We are also saying, in fact, that provision was part of an amendment. The previous text used to say may apply, so which was optional. So the House went through an amendment of the BBBE Act to change the word may to must. So we are here to say the bill, as it's presented today, insofar as transformation is aligned with the BBBE Act. And I'm going to read just 1.A that says, in determining qualification criteria in the issuing of licenses. So now this says to the regulator that when you issue licenses, you must apply the BBBE code. I'm going to just, at the high level, Chairperson, say this code is an industry agreement. It's not a government-imposed transformation tool. The ICT sector wrote and committed to the objectives of the Act. So as the Council, we expect both our colleagues in business, industry, and our social partners to be bound by the resolutions that we all agreed to be gazetted. And the first one was, one, to promote the objectives of the Act. The second one is to implement the code. And I think this process, as the House, you are doing your part in making sure that the code is implemented effectively. The third one is to bridge the digital divide, stimulate growth, advance economic and social transformation, and contribute to the eradicating of unemployment and poverty. The sector, through the Council, resolved to support skills development and training initiatives and ensure that we create an environment where the implementation of BBBE in the economy is transparent and consistent. And just last but not least, it's also very important that the targets in the code are minimum targets. So the sector resolved to attempt to exceed, and it says where possible meet and exceed the targets. So in a perfect world, this sector would be exceeding the targets that are in the code. I'm not going to go to details in terms of the code. We have provided it in the presentation in terms of how the code is structured. But the code that is referred in the bill, it talks to the issues around how does this tool help the sector to achieve the objectives of the BBBE Act that is passed by the House. The only part that I would like just to make an emphasis on through you, Chairperson, is the issue of ownership. So in the ICT sector, the sector committed to 30% ownership as the minimum compliance target. Now, it's very important to understand that from a transformation point of view, when we talk about ownership, we distinguish between the type of people. In this case, we make reference to black people, and that's the transformation aspect. We also separate whether someone owns or someone benefits or someone controls, because in the form of ownership of equity, someone can be given shares, but they might not benefit, and they can tick that they own shares. So in fact, in the current environment, in the current act, the ECA Act, you cannot distinguish whether someone is entitled to dividend or they control the entity. So what the BBBE Act separated those. And then what the also Act does, it also distinguish people that were already in the system or new players. So the transformation aspect that you are now embarking on is to allow participation of new players in the sector. I think that's the part I would like to talk to in terms of the House, insofar as transformation around ownership. The other part is the issue of black women. So in the BBBE Act, in terms of the code, this process would now distinguish the ownership between black male and black women. So when we come here to come and report in a year's time, we will be able to distinguish to say, how did the licensing process of the spectrum allocation empower black women? So this amendment, this bill, will allow the House to be able to get those reports, which in the past you couldn't. I'm now going to go straight, Chairperson, to our submission as a Council and hand over to my Deputy Chair, Councillor Pilati.
Councillor, you're on the floor.
Thank you, Chairperson. So
Our submission as the council is that we welcome the proposed amendments on the ECA bill, and we welcome them in the respect that the ECA bill now complies with Section 3 of the BBBEE Act, as my colleague, Councillor Andile, has already alluded to. And we say that the bill, so it complies with Section 3 in that it says that any person, so this is Section 3 of the BEE Act, it says that any person applying the BEE Act must interpret it so as to give provision, so as to give effect to its objectives and purposes and to comply with the Constitution. And then secondly, we are saying that the bill provides for the code as a tool to transform the sector. And in this respect, the bill correlates with Section 9. Section 9 says the amendment seeks to make it clear that the broad-based black economic conditions must be prescribed, and this is what ICASA is enjoined to do. Thirdly, we say we welcome the bill in that it removes ambiguity in the implementation of the code. And in this respect, we welcome the provision of Section 1 of the bill, which defines the BBBEE ICT sector code, and this replaces what was the charter, because as my colleague has already said, this the lead up to this came as an industry initiative, and it started off as a charter, but now we welcome the fact that it is recognized as an ICT code. We say that in the second instance, the bill removes ambiguity in the implementation of the code, in that Section 59B, the term ICT charter is also substituted with the BBBEE ICT sector code. So we see perfect alignment there between the propositions in the bill and our sector code. And then fourthly, we say, Chair, that the bill promotes the objectives of the BBBEE Act of 2013. We will also refer back to Section 9, where the amendment makes it clear that the broad-based black economic conditions must be prescribed. And lastly, we say that the bill promotes the objectives of Section 10 of the BBBEE Act, and in this respect, I'm just going to read Section 10 of the BEE Act that enjoins every organ of state and public entity to apply any relevant code of good practice issued in terms of the Act. And in doing this way, in determining qualification criteria for the issuing of licenses, concessions, and other authorizations in respect of economic activity in terms of the law, in that it makes provision for developing and implementing a preferential procurement policy. It makes provision for determining qualification criteria for the sale of state-owned enterprises, for developing criteria for entering into partnerships with the private sector. And here for us, the relative weight is partnerships with the private sector. And lastly, in determining the criteria for the awarding of incentives, grants, and investment schemes in support of broad-based black economic empowerment. Thank you, Chair. That's our presentation.
Short and sweet.
Yeah. We did respect your request.
I was concerned about the thickness of the document, but you've been very able to present it within the record time, and thank you very much.
I thought we should give you the highlights, Chairperson, because we've given you the presentation that you can use in your deliberations.
Thank you. Colleagues, Mr. McKenzie, sir. Madam Shin, you also want to come in? Okay. And are you fine? Good. Mr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Chairperson. Morning, everybody. Thank you for the presentation. Very, very clear and succinct. Just a little question. You know, in political parties, we all claim to speak on behalf of the poor. You know, this amorphous mass of people that we represent. You mentioned the representation of youth and women on your council. What bodies or organizations sit on the council that represent that particular target market and demographic, if you can just give me an indication of that? And in terms of a starting point for your code, in other words, to assess the degree of transformation within the sector, what have you used as your starting point? And let's just take an example, ownership, for example. What have you used to base your progression model on? So what's your starting point for that? What is your market analysis, especially in terms of ownership? Thank you, Chairperson.
Oh, good. Oh, you want to come in, madam? Oh, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chair. When you say we are late where? We are late in a process, we are late in an industry, we are late. Can you please tell us where we are late? Thanks, Chair.
Is there anyone else somewhere who would like to have anything to say? I don't think so. Alf, will you pop? Before the DG.
No, Chair, except to say it seems to be a presentation that's supports the bill. I agree with that view, at least the view that this bill will ensure that the BBBEE ICT sector code becomes more enforceable through the ICASA licensing process. So we also look forward to that new regime in future under this bill. Thank you, Chair.
DG, you're fine. I guess the presentation for me is very clear. It's instructive. All I would want to say, because I know people have been presenting and leaving. Earlier on when I made my comments, I did say there's a window of an open window for engagement where we expect of the department, the industry, and whoever else to workshop certain parts of the bill. I think the participation of the council in that process to guide, because you actually are practitioners, would actually help guide everyone who is involved, so that when we finally, when the future, the next parliament or the next committee revisits the bill and finally enact that legislation, they are actually thoroughly guided so that we are within the guidelines of the code, as it were. You have an opportunity to respond to the questions raised, Madam Councillor.
Perhaps I should start with the request for clarity on the workshop sessions. When are those proposed for?
Yeah.
Because the council would like to avail it.
They will be, we are actually saying, because Parliament is adjourning next week, Friday. Until next year, I think next year is going to be the State of the Nation and then going to be the budget presentation. And the Parliament prorogues, in other words, we get dissolved. So we are gone, and the only people who remains in power are the DGs and company. That's now a window that gets opened for people to do all their good things. They are now in power. I mean, the DG is almost a minister of the department. Although the minister remains there, the minister also is not sure whether he's coming or she's coming back. The next parliament, you know, you don't know whether to get voted in, the another party takes over, the ANC get 100%, or the DA comes in with a good margin, or the EFF wallops everyone off. We don't know what's going to happen. The electorate will then have to say. But during that period, we are saying, let the department, because they are not being voted, these ones are employed permanently, let the department, let the industry, let ICASA, let the one proponents, let everyone else converge and workshop certain aspects where there are differences. We've identified about 5 or 7 areas where there are differences. And I know that the issue of BBBEE has come in a way, because I can't remember who made the presentation, where there were talks of PDIs versus the BBBEE. I know, I think on Tuesday there was such a presentation. So that those things are clarified and we are sure as to where we are. But also empowering people who may not necessarily be up to speed with the level of the depthness of the act as it stands. So I'm saying everyone that is involved, it becomes the DG's responsibility to ensure that some of these things that we are talking about must actually happen, so that the new parliament and the new committee could be given some narrowed down work for them to process the bill. So the person who is in charge is that man next to Alf. He will have to run the events together with the ladies that are seated there and other ladies that are seated somewhere up there. So I'm just saying, I hope that they will make sure that you are part of it. And I was, when Alf responded, he said, yeah, he believes that we are properly guided. So they, between yourselves and them, you'll exchange numbers, and let's make sure that that interface continues. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just to respond to the question about who represents the youth in our council, we have Councillor Murisi Ramunyai, who represents the youth. We have Councillor Thulani Tsefuta, who is on the council by virtue of his membership of the community from, you know, NEDLEC, but he is also the president of the youth council, so he gives quite a big input when we talk about that as a sector. And I know I wasn't asked this question, but we also have Councillor Petronella Linders from the Department of Trade, from the Department of Telecoms and Postal Services, and she also gives input on people with disabilities and how they are affected by the work that we do.
Just in terms of the starting point on ownership, the process to transform the sector formally started in 2003 in the form of a charter. And a charter is an industry non-binding document or obligation. And the starting point was to basically bring all the parties into the group, into the room, and say, what is the starting point from ownership level? So we started with parties asking for 40% compliance, and then there were those that were saying 25.1. And we felt at that time that the middle ground for the industry would have been 30%. We felt the 30% ownership was also in line with the then Telecommunications Act that prescribed at the time that licenses should be up to 30%, so that we meet everyone. So that was our starting point. So 30% has always been the starting point for ownership. In terms of the question, how late, what does that reference to? So when the BBBEE Act was promulgated in 2013, it gave a year for a bill like this one to be aligned to the Act. And it says, if you have not done so, irrespective, we will trump you. So in the BBBEE Act, then it says, we will trump you. There's a trumping clause. And what this did, effectively, it put ICASA into a corner, because ICASA is actually forced by law to apply the code. And on the other side, the legislative imperative that ICASA uses, which is the ECA, was referring to words like charter. And so this process basically should have actually happened around 2013, so that at least by 2014, the amended Act is basically passed by the House, if that makes sense. Insofar as the transformation aspect, And then just also, and just to add, when the Act was, the BBBEE Act was promulgated, it now has a new provision in terms of the enforcer, which is the BEE Commissioner. So what you are now going to see in the Act, it prescribes fines for non-compliance or if you don't implement the code. I mean, there are also cases of imprisonment if professionals or companies circumvent this code. So you will see that even after, let's assume you're coming back, that this process would now have teeth, unlike in the past. So the bill is very much welcomed in the sector.
Thank you. Sir, Babu Andil.
Yes,
no, Councillor, you've made yourself very, very clear. Baba McKenzie, and in the meantime, whilst Baba McKenzie is speaking, I'm going to request the Madam Katrina to move forward to the table. Kubeka ke baba ndathe.
Ngiyabonga so mlungu. Yeah, thanks for partially answering the question. Since 2003, I'm trying to get an idea of where the council sees the industry in terms of transformation. You've told me your starting point in 2003. Have you done any market reviews since then based on ownership? Because what are we talking about, 15 years? how has the industry moved in terms of ownership? And when you look at ownership or transformation of the industry, do you take into account things like listed companies, the PIC involvement, government shareholding in Vodacom, which is warehoused, I believe? So do you take that into account when you look at ownership? But specifically, if we can just go back, have you done a market review that can indicate how far the industry has moved in the last 15 years? Thank you, Chairperson.
But Andil.
Last 15 years, no, we didn't. And the reason, probably the same position that this committee finds itself. The 2012 code was promulgated or gazetted, and the council only came into operation in October 2015. So we've only been around for less than 4 years. The only report we produce is what we call the annual monitoring report with the assistance of the department. So we are going to produce the third one, and we hope to present at least a three-year view on ownership next time we come to this house. To answer your question around PIC, government shareholdings, the code makes it explicit in terms of how you measure those. And what this bill will do will now ensure that there's a consistent way of measuring ownership. Yes, the listed investments are taken into consideration, but depending on whether they represent the real black people instead of institutional investments. In the code, for example, government shareholding is always excluded in the ownership, because the black people that are referred to are actually excludes state ownership per se. But we are happy to present the third report that will give you a three-year view on how we have progressed in terms of ownership. Honorable Mr.
McKenzie, are you fine?
Thanks, Chair. I have a problem with real black people, but I won't drive this. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. McKenzie, are you suggesting that the government is black?
No.
And what about the Western Cape government?
Thank you, Chair. I will ask Dr. French and Bombo to reply to that particular question. But, Chair, you know, if we're saying that people who own shares in companies or people who are invested in companies through government are somehow not real black people, that shareholders or 6 million black middle classes are not real black people, Chair, I have an issue with that. Thank you, Chair.
Government is colorless. Government is super colorless. Government can never be black. You wanted to come in on studies, and then I'll come back to put Andy.
No, I was on that one of the blackness, but
um, Mackenzie, ungangeni kuleyo ndaba leyo. It's going to take us to the land expropriation or that compensation. Can you come in,
Chair? Thanks. I want to withdraw the word real black people. So what the Act, the Triple B Act does, it defines the black people that are referred to in the Act as those that are South Africans by citizen naturalization or birth and who attained that citizenship prior to the first elections in 1994. So the reference to black is actually now defined. That's actually what it constitutes. So if the mandated investments can be traced to those individuals, yes, they will count.
If I can just add, Chair, I think what informed Councillor Andile's use of that term is because in the last two annual monitoring reports that we've been doing on transformation in the sector, we found that there are some companies who would use trusts, but at the end we do not see human beings.
Or people.
Yes, or people at the end. So the beneficiaries are trusts. And in effect, the stance that we have taken is that BEE must benefit human beings at the end of the line, and they must benefit black people as mandated by the Act.
I think these guys are very thorough. Mackenzie, yehani yo black kree akterele rehani. So, thank you very much for the exposition. I think a very rich presentation, and we can only be better. Thank you very much, and let's stick closer to the process, and let's make sure that we can achieve the objectives as you have said. We are taking in Madame Katrina Pillay. You remember she was supposed to have been, she was there in the meeting on Tuesday, and then she was unwell. I sent her off and requested her to rest. And she's back today. Hopefully she's perfect. I can see she's smiling. She's okay. Madam, we are in your hands.
Good morning, Chairperson, committee, DG, department, and stakeholders. Thank you for the opportunity for the SACF to present and submit our written comments on the bill. The SACF is an industry association that represents a broad cross-section of participants in the ICT sector. We've previously submitted, our comments are based on a balanced view provided by that represents our members' agreed positions, and we hope that our comments would contribute to taking this dialogue further. We particularly support the objectives of the bill that promote transformation, lowering the cost of communications and increasing competitors. The point of this slide is it just gives you the big picture and the context of what we think we're trying to do. So we need universality at affordable rates, and that requires significant capital investment. Networks aren't cheap and require ongoing investment in upgrades, and current licensees spend significant amounts in terms of investment annually. And that's how we have the networks. What we need is regulatory certainty that promotes investment. It's very difficult for people to invest in an environment where there's no regulatory certainty. And if you look at the annual reports or you look at any of the reports of any of the existing licensees, they are all required to invest on an ongoing basis, and that is essentially stems from the fact that services have to be provided at lower costs, and the capacity keeps increasing. And demands for quality, and if you look at the types of services that people want, they become much more bandwidth intensive, so there's ongoing investment. In terms of the process and the impetus for the EC amendment bill, we welcome the opportunity that we had previously to have commented in the previous process of the bill that was published in November 2017 and in the subsequent workshop held by the department in March 2018. And we as we understand it, the EC amendment bill is an implementation of the integrated ICT white paper. However, we have a few concerns. If the EC amendment is meant to be an implementation of the white paper, why have we selected these particular issues for inclusion in the bill and excluded other issues? We're also concerned that there's been a relatively short process for consultation. Yes, there's been the 30 days for written comments, but in our view, the period for consultation and the review of the bill here is very short, and we were very pleased to see that the committee has heard some of these concerns that have been raised by us and various other stakeholders in terms of the amended process that we understand to be unfolding, and that the bill won't be concluded within this sitting, which was our initial understanding. So I think we're very pleased with that. It's also of concern to us that there's a parallel process. In September 2018, the minister issued a draft policy direction on the licensing of high-demand spectrum and the licensing of the WOAN. Those two elements are also incorporated in the bill. Based on our understanding, that it would be adequately addressed in through the policy direction. Accordingly, we don't understand why it's included in the bill as well. Then we are concerned about the reduction of the roles of the regulator. The regulatory reform process that South Africa had undertaken during the late 90s and early 2000s that resulted in the ICASA that we see, seems some of that independence and some of the role seems to be being rolled back in this EC amendment bill. We don't quite understand the rationale for that, and perhaps if we understood the rationale, there could be alternate methods of addressing it as opposed to trying to roll back some of the reforms that we've already achieved. Then we're concerned that in terms of the bill seems to increase the obligations of ICASA. There are a number of things that ICASA is required to do. One such example is the market reviews. They are required to identify all the markets and then go through a process. It's our understanding that they would have to identify the markets in each instance anyway. So it's difficult to understand why they would be required to conduct a labor-intensive and expensive process of identifying all the markets, then going market by market. A second such example is the fact that they have to review the markets every 3 years. It's a very difficult and expensive process. So when we have these discussions, it's difficult to understand the rationale for that, especially when we know that there's another bill that we were told that was coming. We thought in the current sitting, perhaps not, but at any rate, we know that there's another bill coming. It would be more useful for us to look at this holistically as opposed to separately. This just sets out a brief history of the regulatory reform, which is more detailed in our written comments. Essentially what it talks to is the fact that pre-97 we had we didn't have a separation of powers. Post-97 we embarked on that process of separating the regulator, the policy maker and the players. So in terms of some of the proposed amendments in the bill, it's a bit unclear as to why some of this is being rolled back. And such an example is the minister currently issues guidelines to ICASA in terms of the spectrum, and ICASA will develop the frequency plan and the minister approves. So it's a bit confusing as to why we're trying to change that. We don't understand what is actually being trying to be cured. If we understood that, perhaps there could be alternative solutions, I don't know. But we do understand that the separation of powers is important. And what seems to have come across at various intervals is, firstly, an independent regulator was created, and that independence is aligned to global best practice. It's also the basis on which the ITU assesses regulatory environments, which is contained in more detail in our submission. While the regulator is meant to be independent, independence is not absolute in our understanding. Independence relates to the fact that the regulator should be able to execute its functions without fear, favor, or interference. That doesn't in any way mean that it operates separate from legislation and policy. It still operates within that framework. Our understanding of regulatory independence is that the regulator would be enabled to execute its functions administratively without interference. So the rolling back of what looks like the rolling back of the regulator's independence is a bit confusing for us based on our understanding of what an independent regulator is. The next issue that we raise, and we are only picking out some of the key concerns for us in the bill, the other comments that are more detailed, we believe the committee would be able to engage with. So the licensing of the WON. The bill seems to make the assumption that you need to create a space to license a WON in the bill, which we don't understand, because our understanding is the WON is an individual electronic communications network service license. And because it's an individual electronic network service license, it's already catered for in the bill. What it needed was the for ICASA to issue an ITA for an IECNS, the minister was required to issue a policy direction, which we believe he's done with the draft policy that's being finalized. So that then gives effect to the trigger to allow ICASA to invite applications for IECNS licenses. We think that the policy direction adequately covered maybe in a bit more detail than was required, but it did set out the parameters of what ICASA ought to include in the ITA, and we think that that's covered there. We are of the view that it's not necessary to amend the ECA to include the licensing of the WON. Then in terms of spectrum licensing, the spectrum licensing has been that the proposed amendments in the bill are quite confusing to us in the sense that the licensing of spectrum has been a clearly separated function which seems to have worked. Perhaps there are areas for improvement, but why we would try to walk it back, walk some of the current provisions back, is a bit unclear. And I think the DG on Tuesday quite nicely articulated the roles. So I think the one thing that the whole industry would agree on is that we need to license spectrum urgently. The absence of licensing of spectrum for more than a decade has been detrimental to the industry at large. What it's done is it's severely constrained existing licensees, and it's prevented the 300-odd IECNS licensees. I'm not trying to say that all 300 would have gone to market, but those that wanted to and could have applied for spectrum were unable to do so because there was no process for the licensing of spectrum. And we're very glad to see that there is some movement in this regard. with the policy direction that the ministers issued, which we understand ought to be finalized fairly soon. Like I said, that is the most welcome change. So in terms of the spectrum licensing, we understand that it must be fair and transparent, and the ECA adopts a technology-neutral approach, which again makes it a little confusing in terms of the proposed amendments. Like, for example, when spectrum is issued for you to reform it, you would have to go to a council for approval. That's a bit unclear, because once the spectrum has been issued, one would assume that the technology is irrelevant. It's simply about the efficiency. Then the bill also goes on to talk about the attaching USOs. We are of the view that perhaps that's something that ought to be best left to the regulator instead of it being incorporated in the bill. And there's nothing new about attaching USOs to spectrum licenses. This has happened for various bands of spectrum. So the licensing of high demand spectrum, as I've said, that's been addressed in a policy direction. So it's a bit unclear as to why the bill includes that when it's already been taken care of in terms of the policy direction. Secondly, it's extremely confusing in the sense that the bill attempts to move away from the exclusive assignments of spectrum to an open access basis. Then it also talks about, before I go to the other part, there's a shift from exclusive licensing to open access. The exclusive licensing is essentially buying a property, and you're saying that it attracts a certain value, so that relates to the price. So when you take that away, it's unclear how you would charge on an open access basis. Then the bill also talks about spectrum sharing and spectrum trading. In order for you to trade something or for you to share it, the assumption is that you actually own it. But if you don't, it again makes it extremely unclear in terms of the open access. Also, how would the licensing fees work in terms of the bill if you only get to have access to the spectrum in the same way as you would to a park, which is on an open access basis? It also makes it extremely difficult in terms of how networks required to plan and provision, what would be the basis? How would they actually be able to do that when you're not guaranteed of having access to something? And as we understand it, the open access basis works on in the bands that are unlicensed. Some of the obligations in the bill clearly seeks to ensure universality of services, which we support. However, the manner in which it's done makes it extremely difficult and doesn't recognize the properties of spectrum. For example, if you look at a low band like 700 or 800, in terms of the propagation of spectrum, it works better for rural coverage, because it gives you broader coverage, but not necessarily capacity. So you have to use that in tandem with the higher bands. And when you look at them as though they're completely separate, and for each band, as we understand it, what it looks like in the bill, you're required to roll out in a rural area before you roll out into an urban area, doesn't necessarily align to the properties of the spectrum. We think that it would be more useful to align rollouts to the properties of the spectrum, and we're not saying we don't think rural areas should be covered. We think that should be part of a discussion in terms of how it could be best done in the most efficient manner, because ultimately you want to have universality of services and coverage, but at the same time you need it to be done in the most efficient way possible. If the rollouts are not done in the most efficient way as possible, then that impacts the cost of communications, which I think is something that's extremely important in our context. Transformation is the final issue I'd like to touch on, is that in terms of transformation, the SACF has a long history in terms of promoting black people to participate in the ICT sector. And ICASA raised this, and I think this is a very key issue for the sector. The ECA includes the, or uses the term historically disadvantaged individuals, but it doesn't define it, which makes it a complicated process in itself, in the absence of a definition. At the same time, like the council has pointed out, ICASA has to consider the codes. So when you consider the codes, it makes reference to black people, which is a different measure from historically disadvantaged people. So when, for example, if you try to do a license transfer at ICASA, it becomes a very complicated process because you can't then use your BE certificate to demonstrate your level of compliance and the level of ownership that you have. You have to have another document, which is a very complex exercise because there is no framework for HDIs in the same way. So it would be much better in our view if the ECA changes, if the term is changed in the ECA from HDIs to black people. So then you have better alignment. It doesn't take away from any of the obligations of the ECA. It just simply uses a single reference of black people. So it reduces the level of complexity, and it also reduces the compliance cost, whereas somebody has to go and have two different measures done to achieve the same thing. And ultimately, we're trying to achieve transformation. So our proposal is to change the term HDI to black people. In conclusion, we'd like to just say we don't understand the urgency of the bill. And again, we are pleased with the approach that the committee has adopted, because the burning issues in our understanding with the licensing of the drone and the licensing of high demand spectrum, we think those have been adequately taken care of in terms of the policy direction. And we think that there needs to be a socioeconomic impact assessment, or RIA, in terms of the bill before it progresses, because the impact of the bill is far-reaching, and we think that it would be better to do it more comprehensively and not simply just incorporate comments, because, yes, we acknowledge that everybody's comments aren't necessarily included, because it's a balancing act, trying to balance the interests of the different stakeholders. We think this would be a much more scientific way of doing it. Thank you.
Thank you, madam. Colleagues, that's the presentation. Any takers? And the DG will get used to be a priest. You know, when for some of us who occasionally do preach from time to time, you reach the same verse repeatedly and preach with it for quite some time, so you call it a series, and you must repeat yourself on certain things, because I think it's an exercise we'll need to clarify so that all of us remain on board, and that's part of the process. Madam Shin.
Thank you, Chairperson. In your presentation, you said there were many issues from the white paper, important issues that should have been included in the bill, and they're not here. Can you please explain what those issues are that you think that perhaps should be there? Also, much of what is in the bill already exists in the ECA, just hasn't been implemented. And a lot of that is because ICASA has been historically under-resourced financially and with skills. What do you believe ICASA needs to be given to, if we recommend to the next parliament, that ICASA must be properly equipped to fast-track the issues that are already in the ECA to give effect to what the aims of the white paper are. Amongst your members, are there any small businesses that have licenses that they haven't been able to use because Spectrum isn't available or wasn't available to them, either on a cost basis or whatever is holding them back? I think that's it. Thank you.
Just one question here, Chair. Like we earlier commented on the process of transformation, and on slide 8 here, you talk about the process that must be fair and transparent. In your opinion, or how would you consider, this fairness, what is it going to see and say the process is fair in terms of the spectrum licensing?
I guess I've covered all members. I don't know whether the council would like to, I know you've raised some of the things, but if you feel that you'd like to speak to some of the issues that Madam Katrina have raised, feel free. And so should ICASA councillors, if they also deem it necessary. And if you do, you're fine. When you say, I'm here, or I'm fine, I must get used to your sign language.
So, Chair, the waiving was meant for the BEE council member. But it's fine, we will fill in once the council has clarified certain issues.
Are there things that you'd like to reflect on, Triple B? On the issues that she has raised?
Not at this stage, after the colleagues have made submissions.
No,
after she has responded to the issues that have been raised.
She'll be the last to speak.
Oh, okay.
Post her comments, she opens and she closes.
No, there's nothing.
Alf?
Thank you, Chairperson. If I can start with why the clarification on why selected aspects from the white paper were included in this particular bill. Chair, we've had to go through a difficult exercise of determining what should move forward. And a white paper is not enforceable despite being a government policy. So if a white paper says ICASA must do this, ICASA must do that, it doesn't mean it will necessarily happen. Or if it says the sector must move to open access, it doesn't necessarily mean it will happen. So we had to then identify what are the critical enablers and take that work forward. The mistake we've perhaps made was to include too much in this bill. So it was a balancing act. On the one hand, there's too much here, which means every single presentation and every single consideration, even a parliamentary process, it gets massive all the time because it's just huge what's in this bill. But at the same time, it's only a drop in the bucket in terms of what's in the white paper. So we said as a department, we'll have to change gear and get into the mode of introducing bills probably every year going into the future to really address the matters in the white paper. Otherwise, you run the risk that there's no policy implementation at the end of the day. For example, under SA Connect, no legislation followed to give it a bit of teeth, and hence a lot of it would remain or potentially be unimplemented because there's no regulatory enforcement around it. But in any event, if we talk about consultation, we would have to allude to the fact that this has been the most extensive consultation on a process and a bill in the history of this department. I wouldn't even go to the extent of the white paper process, but even after that, where the minister immediately after the white paper started engaging the industry. I have a document somewhere reflecting on each and every meeting, and it's a long list, starting in Sandton up to Burgess Park in Pretoria and all over the place. Eventually there was a bill, and then the public hearings. For the first time, this department that I recall had public hearings on, or public submissions, public participation, workshops on a bill. I do not recall in my history having that, which we can thank this particular DG for. Similarly, the number of engagements, anyone that wanted a meeting, we entertained such meetings. The DG even, we even before the media at some point and investors and answering their questions. So I think it was quite a consultative process, Chair, but with your leadership and guidance, we will continue that consultation even beyond these hearings. The policy direction versus the bill, let's say that at the time of drafting the bill, a decision wasn't taken yet to do a policy direction as such. So that's why it was there to start off with. However, the provisions are still necessary even after the current policy direction to strengthen the whole process legally, to strengthen the one so that future processes of future high demand spectrum has a proper governance and legal framework. If you read all the perceived legal concerns raised under the current policy direction process, you'll be able to make the connection. If the policy direction or the CASA process that should follow on the policy direction is tied up in court's chair, then the bill will prove to be valuable still. We have, however, said that the bill has to be aligned with the developments under the policy direction when it is issued. The matter of not all markets that we're going overboard with requiring under Section 67 that all markets must be defined and that process there. Market definition cannot be a reactive process, Chair. When a problem exists, then define the market like was done under the wholesale termination rate exercise. So in the last round, ICASA has come, we think, close to what is required by this bill and what was required under the white paper to determine all the relevant markets and what those markets are and determine which markets are priority markets for review. And then in the bill takes further requiring a schedule of such intended reviews. In our view, that creates certainty. It aligns with international best practice, so that one knows what are the markets that are involved in a country and enables a regulator and everyone to focus, but to ensure openness and clarity in a process. Thank you, Chair.
DG?
Thanks, Chair. I didn't speak in the earlier discussion because ALF is our expert on triple B. And has covered the issues well. Now, just very quickly, Chair, on my side, I think there's a question as to whether the bill is being rushed through Parliament. In our view, that should not arise because after all is said and done, we have nowhere else to go, but we have to come to the House and say, this is what we have done, and hand over the process to Parliament. And Parliament, in its wisdom, will then determine the process. So there is nothing really to substantiate any insinuation that the bill is being rushed, because we can't tell Parliament how to run its processes. And by the way, Chair, we accept the guidance that Parliament is providing to us in terms of how we need to proceed. Not that we, because we don't have a choice, as you are our principals on this matter, but because what you are saying is the correct way of resolving outstanding issues. Now, in terms of the issue of the powers of the authority, here is a case, Chair. I picked on one issue last time, on Section 34 of the current Act, which says that the Minister must approve the radio frequency plan developed by the authority. Now, I ask a question as to what is the wisdom of this House to say that one institution must develop a plan and the other one must approve? Why isn't that the House could have said that the one who develops the plan then develops and approves it? Because what there is a catch in this discussion, Chairperson, that there was something intended in giving certain powers to the minister and certain powers to the authority. My understanding is that that was not done to say we have a problem, let's give at least one a bit of something, resulting in paralysis. That was not the intention of the legislature to say that we are stuck in terms of the power, so let's just give the minister and say you develop, you must develop, you must approve. There is substance in each action that must be taken by either of the parties. So what we are trying to do is to give context to the role of the minister and say, if you must approve something, what does it mean? We were told then 2 days ago that must approve. So meaning that what you are given, you must just approve it, irrespective of what you think about it. We do not agree that that was ever the intention of the legislator to say the minister must just approve what is provided. Because if that was the intention, it would have been better to just say ICASA must just do this, Chairperson. So there is something that's not coming up in terms of what was the intention of the legislature, and we've been quoting the Act to explain where the catch is. And I dealt with the issue of trust deficit, which is manifest in many of the issues being raised here. Now, Chair, when the white paper was finalized in 2016, there was an outcry that certain aspects of the white paper were not in line with the legislation, because the white paper was issued under two pretexts. One, constitutional, the powers of the executive to issue policy, and two, in terms of the Act. What then happened, Chair, was after people said that certain sections of the white paper were not in line with the law, we're left with one option: to take everything that was in the white paper and translate it into a bill. Of course, not everything, but issues that relate in the main to infrastructure. So why did we do that? Because the white paper, as Alfred indicated, would not have applied without a legislative instrument. So you have to take the white paper, translate it into legislation, and subject it to consultation. Now, Chair, there were certain issues that were raised by industry in our consultation on the first draft of the bill. But in some areas, deliberately, we chose to still come to Parliament with those issues, to say that these are interesting and fundamental issues. As much as we have listened to the industry, it's better also for the representatives of the people in the form of Parliament to also have a bite on those issues and assist us to find each other. So there are things that we believe in ourselves with respect to the first session of consultation, but felt that it was necessary also for you to have a sense of the kind of issues that we're grappling with, so that when we find solutions, it should be such that you have also guided us on how best to resolve issues. Now, is Section 5-6 of the current Act enough to license the one or ones as we move on and on? Partially, yes. You can invoke Section 5-6 of the current Act to license an individual
electronic communications network service. But here is a problem. The problem is when you do that, and that network ends up without spectrum. It's like what we have done, you and I are former councillors, I'm just citing us, not necessarily responding to you, I just want to illustrate, Chairperson, that we know that having been at ICASA, we've been trying to license paid television services. But every time we've attempted to do so, they didn't take off because they didn't have the oxygen that is required to operate a paid television service, which is content. So similarly in this case, you can invoke Section 5-6 and license an IECNS, but doesn't have spectrum. Like there are already many that do not have access to the radio frequency spectrum. So the attempt here is to ensure that going forward when we license is fit for purpose, we are licensing to die, to kill, like we did, what happened with the USALS, for an example. So, Che, that is the mischief that we're trying to cure by expanding Section 5-6 in some way to link it with spectrum licensing, that what you license must operate, otherwise it does not help us. Che, lastly, let's deal with the issue of open access principles and even attempt to demystify it. Now, here's the question. The first question is, what is this thing that we're talking about? It is defined in page 3, is subsection D, that general open access principles means providing wholesale open access on terms that are effective, transparent, and non-discriminatory. Now, why would you do that? Particularly in an environment where the big companies are beginning to share, sign very big commercial deals that are worth billions. Now, it is happening with the big four companies that are entering into those deals. But at the same time, there was a presentation by ISPA and WISPA, or what's it, WAPA, where they showed us that their own members have 8,000 sites that they've built, and I'm talking about the WAPA alone. They have 8,000 sites. Now, as they operate those 8,000 sites, they also want to interconnect with it and lease facilities of the big companies. So we must not be misunderstood, Chair, because what we're saying is we welcome what is happening in the industry as far as the major companies are concerned. But the question we are posing is, what happened to the 8,000 sites that also want to operate, want to lease facilities? Because they want to do that, as it was presented in this house. Now, what are we proposing? When we say open access principles that don't discriminate against those small operators, because it is very possible that the big companies can enter into deals, but when they offer to small companies, they don't offer them the same kind of opportunities that they offer each other. So non-discrimination simply means that what you do to each other is big companies. Please do the same to small companies, Chairperson, because it's very possible that that can happen. So the open access principle demystified is intended to ensure that those small companies that also want to enter industry can be allowed to do so. So if there is a problem, I think it would be good if colleagues can be very specific in terms of how do we deal with this concern, you know, that we have, that we're trying to protect the small men. There's no other intention. And here we're talking about very small kind of companies that also want to access the infrastructure of the main companies. That is what is intended by this section, Chairperson. Thank you.
Mr. Andile, sir.
Thank you, Chair. We concur with the SACF on their submission around the need to align the Act. However, we come here and say from a transformation process, this process is long overdue. They come and say, what's the rush? So what I wanted Ms. Pillay to maybe try and assist the EU chair and the House is that the committee is that how would the regulator license issue licenses and comply with the BBB Act in terms of the current ECA Act when the definitions are not aligned in terms of, as she alluded to, the difference between black people and PDIs, the reference in the Act of the Charter and the ambiguity. So I just wanted her to maybe take the committee. I'm not sure if there's anything you want to add. Thank you.
Well, Councillor.
Thanks, Chair. Just to add to the suggestion that...
Should I say ICASA Councillor? Yes. But they think that I'm meaning Municipal Councillor.
Okay, no, thanks, Chair. Just to maybe try and amplify the submission that has been made by the SACF. I understand it to mean that what they would like to see happening in the bill is the alignment between the measures, the transformational measures that have been outlined within the BBBEE bill with that are contained within ICASA, the ICASA Act and the ECA Act. In particular, the definition of HDI, which is seen to be at loggerheads or limited as compared to what is included in the BBBEE Act. And the suggestion that they are making is actually that the definition should be aligned. Instead of having HDI, it should be scrapped, and that you use black people concurrently for both the BBBEE Act and the ECA Act and the ICASA Act. To that extent, that issue is covered in our submission, and we are supportive of that. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps just to clarify, when... I mean, in the presentation here, the rush was not speaking to the department. It was speaking to Parliament. It was everyone's concern, just that everyone misread what we had put on our program. But I did qualify to members when we started the process. I said, by day 20 minus 7, by day 13 of, by week 3 of the publication, we only had received 3 submissions. One from KZN, one from Limpopo, and I can't remember where the other one was coming. And I said, in case, because I have to plan, we have to plan, in case there is no submission by day 20, we'll proceed and we have dedicated 2 full weeks to drill the bill. So I said, members, brace yourself, go and exercise sufficiently. For the coming 2-3 weeks, we'll actually drill the bill until the 7th. It may appear as a rush, but if there were no, and that was on the basis that if we don't get substantive submissions, that's what will happen. But what I then did is I engaged a few industry players, and I wanted to know from them. I'm not getting a sense that you guys are making a submission, because now there is no indication it is going to help me to do the work, to finish the bill very fast. Are you going to make a submission? And they said, wait and see. We will surprise you come the 20th. And indeed, Madam Sheen had warned me that we've tried this thing before. They wait for the end time. So she was correct. That's why I had to go and test it. And indeed, on that day in the morning, I did say we only have received 2, so waiting for 4 o'clock at 4. With something like 8 submissions. We then sat in the meeting, like, now that this has happened, and colleagues have been very lenient to allow the chair to run the affairs, if this happens, I am going to then shut the first week, allow members to go and study these piles of documents, but three big box files. And then thereafter, let's start with a hearing before Parliament ends. At that time, it was clear that we will not conclude the process. So she's raising a concern, which is valid, on the basis of our program. And she's not alone. Everyone is raised. I think that is something that had been raised around the fast-tracking of the process in Parliament. With regards to the department, I think there's no accusation for rushing things. The accusation is that, why did that thing stay with you for so long? That's why I did bring the two contradictions, but we are fine. I think I'm right. But you can speak for yourself. Yes.
Thank you for that explanation. That was exactly the concern that we were raising. It wasn't about the department, it was just we were quite concerned that we had 30 days to respond, and based on the parliamentary timetable, it looked like for the conclusion of what we think is an extremely impactful and complex bill. So we were very concerned that the time frames were too short. But then you kind of circumvented it on Tuesday when you extended the process. Thank you for that.
Deal with other issues if there be any.
Sure. The first question with regard to what wasn't included and what ought to have been included. Since I represent a membership, can we please come back to you with a prioritization in terms of what ought to have been included from the white paper into the bill? On the next question, in terms of what ICASA needs, ICASA has consistently raised this issue, and I think it's been raised for close to a decade. At the point of the ICASA amendment bill, there's always been an issue of there's always been a discussion around the funding of ICASA, whether it should be a self-funded model, whether it should be a different model. So funding has always been an issue, and as far as I understand it, their budget in the last year was reduced. Then I think Alison Gilwald had also raised a question about whether this is the current format of the regulator is what we need going forward, which is what I understand the department have been researching, and part of what I understand that we would be seeing in the commission's bill. So the question really is I'm not necessarily advocating for separation or anything like that. I'm just saying, is this the structure and vehicle that we need, or does it need to be tweaked? And I do say tweaked as opposed to being restarted or changed fundamentally, because it becomes a very complex process. It took many years for the integration and for ICASA to become effectively operational, where only recently we've seen, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen significant improvements in terms of achievements against their business plan, which then raises a question which many of our members have raised over the course of the last year is, does the business plan focus on the things that it needs to? And perhaps that's something that we ought to look at. Is ICASA focusing on the right things? And I think that is a bit more of a complex question than simply saying, ICASA, I need you to prioritize on this or that, because there's a whole APP process which becomes more complex. But I think there could be assistance to help ICASA position itself to focus on the most critical areas, and perhaps there could be that sort of process. I hope that answers your question. The next one was, were there some small businesses amongst our members that were not able to begin operations? Yes. We do have some smaller members that do have an IECNS and ECS license, and they, as far as I've understood it, they have had funding, and they've launched in various other countries, except in South Africa they have consistently applied for spectrum, and they've applied for high-demand spectrum, and they've been unable to access any of the high-demand spectrum, which has prevented them from going to market. And while that is a challenge for some of our members, I'm sure it extends to other entities that are not our members as well. The next question, in terms of what would be fair and transparent. A fair and transparent process would be where everyone knows the rules, we understand what the rules are. The licensing methods would be different. Different people have different views. And essentially that would be for the authority and, I guess, in terms of a policy framework to do the licensing. But everybody needs to know the rules and everybody needs to know how to participate effectively, I think. We can give you more detailed information on that if you'd like. And there was a question on the HDI. Essentially what we were saying is that you would need to align the definitions, simply because it's extremely complex for ICASA, it's extremely complex, it's extremely time consuming for licensees that have applied to transfer licenses, and then it becomes an issue of how do you do that measurement, because there isn't an established process in terms of that measurement. It's a very, very cumbersome process, which really costs applicants time and money. I don't know if that's answered your question. I hope it has. That's a no.
I guess that's where we ended. There's tea outside. Madam Shin, you also want to come back? Okay. Madam T?
Yeah, so just a small one on fairness. You know, I hear the response is to say everyone should understand the rules and maybe all the processes. But for me, it's different from, you know, understanding the rules and the benefit from your understanding. You do understand the rules, you do understand what is required, but you benefit from those rules. I mean, fairness in terms of within the context of a transformation, because almost all the small players, you know, the presentations, almost all of them, no, in not so many ways, but it's like we do have this transformation policy, but it doesn't work for us. So I was asking, what would you consider as fair?
Sorry, I meant fairness in
45 seconds.
I don't know if you want me to continue on that basis, but essentially what ICASA has done to assist smaller players, and I think is a useful thing and I think needs to happen, is that very often you find that players don't necessarily, particularly smaller players, don't necessarily understand how to participate in the process. So there needs to be workshops, which ICASA has been doing as far as I'm aware. But from a fairness point of view, I'd meant it slightly differently. But to answer your question, as I understand it, you want to have players participate. So it's really about creating awareness and taking them through the process and workshopping some of the issues so that they could participate more meaningfully.
They will take the discussion forward during TIP. Yeah, Ajira has just organized your TIP because he thought you were doing well in time. If you were not, you were not going to have tea. So credit to the processing the work faster, Hajira gives you a 15 minutes break for tea. Celsi takes off at 11:30. Three minutes time is what? Yeah, that's when we will start. She said 15, but you starting at up 11. So my watch is very flexible. Okay. Once you're done with tea, you folk will come back. But you can also drink water.
Thank you. But I hope you might give me black skin don't come.
White.
Because yours is blind as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can we get seated? Colleagues, the good thing is most of the industry players have been having representatives here, so they have followed every aspect of our engagement. I assume that they were feeding back to their principals. Now, the gentleman about to present here is Mr. Graham. He is a lawyer. By now, you know my attitude towards lawyers. I don't have one. Lawyers are not very good people to negotiate. We normally keep them out of negotiations because they tell you I have an instruction from my client. Let me consult my client whether the instruction is being changed. Graham, here we are not arguing in law. We are busy with the public hearing. It's good to get the law part, the legal part of the aspects, but the bigger part of what we're dealing with is heart. You know, lawyers use their heads a lot. Now, we normal people use our hearts. So we need stronger hearts so that we can listen to people and see how we meet them halfway. Lawyers must use their heads because they get instructions and they must always try and come up tops. And you pay them even for losing, ne? So we will listen to your presentation. We've received your submission and supplements, a very educated presentation, beautiful research, and I think some of us have benefited from your insourcing of the expert knowledge, which has been able to expose the subject, deal with finer details of what has happened elsewhere, and so on and so on. I think a very beautiful document to read that I can only commend. And now it has costed the company money. I don't know how much, because one of these players appears to be the most trusted player across the globe. I mean, even if you Google, you actually find that they are on course almost on a daily basis. They are doing analysis, so it was quite informative for me. I know that originally you had asked for 1 hour, and I gave you 2 hours, and I cut it down to 1:30. Now the tea people, Mr. McKenzie, took another 15 minutes of your time. There is he sitting. He's in charge of our welfare, our food and stuff. So if he says 15 minutes, and I wanted to give 3, he says 15 minutes, his word is final. So these are rules there of engagements that we have there. But Chelsea, welcome, and thank you. You're on the floor.
Great. Thank you for that introduction, Chair, and honourable members. I was, during the tea break, actually having a discussion with some of my colleagues from our competitors, and we were reflecting on the fact that we've all been in the industry for more than 20 years, which is good and bad. I think it's good from the sense that we understand all of the issues very well. We've all become quite expert in the field. But I think the bad is that we often take a lot of things for granted in explanations to us, people who are not as experienced. And we also kind of, it's quite predictable what we think everybody else is going to say. So in other words, I can almost with certainty sit here and know that my competitors from X, Y, and Z company are going to say X, Y, and Z. And likewise, they probably have the same view. I think it's quite important, though, leading into the, before I get into the slide presentation, I just actually want to say a few words generally. And the starting point is that SALFI is overall very supportive of the bill. We think that there are obviously some aspects that can be refined and improved. We've extensively made that clear in our submission, and I'll talk to a few of those today as well. But I think as a principle, we are supportive of the bill. What I think is quite surprising is that there's been so much opposition and criticism from other quarters in the last week. Certainly, I've seen quite a lot of the media around it. Words used like intrusive and onerous, that supporters, for example, of some of the more contentious, and let's be honest, the sort of real points that are the contentious ones are the high demand spectrum and the WOAN aspect in the bill. That anyone who supports the WOAN is jumping on the populist bandwagon. I saw that terminology used. So I'd like to just address that. And I'd like you to carefully consider, as the Chair and the Honourable Members, why people who are opposed to this are so opposed. So the first part is that, you know, what is the Department and the Minister what were they trying to achieve and what are they trying to do? And the issue is, it's a fundamental change that is trying to be achieved. You know, the status quo is what it is, and if we make incremental changes, is that going to get us where we want to be? So we use the word transformation. We use the word transformation in South Africa in a very particular context, but and it's absolutely relevant here. But I think what's also very relevant is transformation of the industry as a whole. Now, government and the departments have a very difficult job. They can't just consider the narrow self-interests of various parties, including SASE. I mean, we are honest about this. We have a very particular interest. But they've got to think about 20 years, 30 years hence. You know, not just 2 to 3 years, the business plans of companies. And that's really what I think this bill is trying to do. It's trying to fundamentally change this industry. Okay. What we have, I think, is a choice. We can, in a sense, spectrum, if you give it and license it in a particular way, it's got a very long-term effect. The decisions you make now by how you get spectrum out into the market will be in place. That will effect will be in place for 10, 15, 20 years hence. So we have to get it right, okay? And one of the choices, well, the choice in my mind is quite simple. Either you give it to the existing incumbents, the guys with all the advantages and all the money, and you say, guys, get on with it. Clearly, in our view, that hasn't worked so far. I mean, you have to trust that they will then take that spectrum, which is a limited and it's a South African asset, and do the right thing with it. Or you have to try and do something else. And I really think that this bill, maybe imperfectly, but that's really where this bill is trying to go to. So I think, as I said, I just want, you know, to consider why would the dominant incumbents, and when I say that, I know there's been talk about the big four. I just like to say that it's actually more, and I will show it in our slides, it's really more the big two and kind of everybody else. So that we will show you. But as I say, why would they oppose this bill in so vehemently? And I think the reason is because they like the status quo, right? They're making lots of money. It works for them. But does it really? I mean, critics are saying that we have a very successful telecommunications industry in South Africa, so why make this fundamental change? And I think we have to ask ourselves, do we really have such a successful industry? Clearly it worked in the past, right? But we're in 2018, and I think we have a problem. In my view, and in a word, that problem is what I call access, right? Now, access, and we all are beneficiaries or not of access. Access has a geographic component, so clearly if you're in an outlying area where there's no network, you won't have access. But importantly, it also has a financial and affordability component, which is as important, right? So if I can't afford the best 5G network services, it's fantastic. We can have the best 5G network around us. I can't afford it, then I don't have access, okay? One of the other criticisms is that introducing the concepts that they have in the bill will chase away investment. Okay. Now, we disagree with that because the construct that has been advanced is not a monopoly, as some people have tried to categorize it. Spectrum will be made available to the operators. Whether it's enough or not enough, that we can debate, but clearly it's not a monopoly either way. In the MTR dispute that went on for years, and Chair, I think you were involved in the industry at the time, but it was a massive fight. It was an industry-wide fight around wholesale termination rates. And the reason it was such an important fight, it was seen as one of the very limited tools that ICASA had to actually fundamentally change some aspects of the industry. But in that fight, the dominant operators said that if you introduced asymmetry in the termination rate, there would be job losses. There would be no more investment. There was a lot of scaremongering. And I use that term, scaremongering. Think about it when you hear a lot of these presentations, because honestly, that's what's happening here. none of those things that were raised actually came to pass. The dominant guys just steamed on ahead, made even more money, and investments carried on. So I really urge you to consider when those scaremongering statements are made, to carefully assess them. So why are the dominant operators acting like this, right? I mean, they're not bad people. They're actually very nice people, personally. But they're acting as perfectly rational capitalists, right? That's what you do. You try and extract the most advantage out of the situation you find yourself in. So when you're a South African manager of Vodacom, for example, and your bosses in Newbury in England are used to getting super profits and super dividends, it's quite difficult to tell them that, you know, you think the Warren is a great idea, where you're going to potentially lose the advantage that you as a company have of having infrastructure that other people don't have, right? So clearly, your bonus is at stake. The profits of the company are potentially at stake. You're going to fight hard. There's no incentive for the dominant operators to bring costs down. It just doesn't happen. Competition is the only thing that does that. So then I ask you, you know, why should you trust what Cell C is saying? Well, firstly, please critically assess what we're saying. We invite you to do that, right? We clearly have a self-interest in a particular outcome. But what I am saying to you is that our interest is much more closely aligned to that of the consumer. I agree with the comment made by Honourable Shin earlier that we need to bear in mind that, you know, what are we actually doing this for? And I think the end user, consumer, is the person that we have to keep focusing on here, because that will just come back to, you know, what's right here. Competition is what brings prices down. And we think, you know, we and other smaller operators are the competition. The Warren is not a monopoly, okay? I did say that. Other operators in the current construct will get high demand spectrum. What's quite interesting is that, as far as I understand, up to quite recently, all of the operators, including the dominant operators, actually supported the concept of the Warren. You will hear this term, the hybrid model, right? Now, the hybrid is not a motor vehicle that runs on petrol and water. It's simple terminology that was adopted to say you get a hybrid, which means you don't just give spectrum to the mobile operators or you don't just give spectrum to the WOA. You have a combination of the two. And that as a concept is, I believe, captured in the bill. So just to finish off on my brief introduction, the duplication of infrastructure is a massive problem in the overall cost base of networks. Simple examples, if you have a base station, then you have a Cell C base station, an MTN, Vodacom, Telkom base station within a kilometre of each other. That you can only have one base station would just as effectively serve, probably, the requirements. You just put all your equipment on that. Maybe you certainly don't need four base stations. And we have a massive duplication of infrastructure in this country. That cost gets passed directly on to the consumer, because where else is it going to go? So if you can suck a lot of that infrastructure duplication cost out of the system, ultimately it will filter down to the consumer. The dominant operators will tell you that they're opposed because their networks are their strategic advantage. You've heard this concept of service-based competition versus infrastructure-based competition, right? We're saying we do need infrastructure in South Africa. Clearly we do need continued investment in infrastructure. But we can't have a situation in 2018 going into 2020, 2025, where you've got networks just duplicating throughout the country. It's a waste of money, it's not helping, and it's driving up the cost. So what I'm saying is that I think what the department has done is quite noble in its intent, because clearly they want to change the status quo, and you need something drastic and fundamental to do that. So just jumping into the presentation itself, and I will be brief, I don't want to bore you. The more interesting stuff is really around the, I guess, the stuff at the end around the Warren. But I think you've already been introduced to our team right at the beginning, so I won't repeat that. But there's five headings in our submission. The current policy, legal and regulatory framework. This is also, I'll whip through this quite quickly because this was also addressed in some of the previous submissions. But obviously the ECA in our industry is the most important piece of legislation. The objects of the ECA have stayed and include, and I think this is very critical, we need to focus on these: promoting broad-based black economic empowerment, promoting inclusion of SMMEs, facilitating affordable and accessible communications, promoting competition, promoting and facilitating investment. Now, just please reflect on those for, you know, a few seconds, because I think that the intention behind these changes in this bill actually do support all of these. I don't think any one of them is necessarily more important than any other. So, for example, the promoting and facilitating investment, you know, as I said, on the scaremongering, there's been a lot of talk that this construct will chase away investment. But it's just one of the aspects that need to be considered. The ECA imposes duties and rights to ICASA to implement national law. And then obviously Parliament is the ultimate body that ensures that national law gives effect to national policy. The ICASA Act is also national law. It's been around for a long time. It's been amended many times. The objects of the ICASA Act have stayed the same, and they include the independence, I think, is the key part that comes through. You can read that in the submission. It's a creature of statute. Obviously, the independence, as was said in the SACF submission, is subject to the Constitution and the law, but ICASA is the body that controls, plans, administers, and manages the use and licensing of radio frequency spectrum, etc. So they are the implementers of the national law in an independent manner. The policy framework, also two national sector policies have been passed, SA Connect and then the white paper. SA Connect, we all, I think, are quite familiar with. One of the main things in SA Connect that I want to highlight is that it aims to ensure that broadband is affordable, and that gets back to the access issue that I spoke about earlier. The white paper is obviously anticipated a new regulatory framework. Okay, it foresaw the introduction of a WAN and the assignment of high demand spectrum to the WAN. Promoting competition and investment, also a clear imperative, and recognise the importance of the independence of the regulatory authority. So I just wanted to highlight that open access is already reflected in the white paper. We've just, on the slide, captured some of the aspects. Core networks will support traditional open access principles. And the DG, in his discussion earlier, spoke about the concept of open access and what it actually means. Demystifying, I think, was the word that he used. Last mile infrastructure, also built on open access network basis. And then digital services and applications. Okay. The next step in the submission, in the presentation, apologies, is the market. Now, I'll also whip through this because I think people are quite familiar, but I just wanted to highlight, and sometimes I do feel like a bit of a stuck record, saying, you know, that CELSE's position in the market and why we find ourselves here. But we were licensed in 2001. Clearly MTN and Vodacom had been in the market for 5 years before us. Telkom was already the incumbent then. SALSI took on the role of consumer champion and disruptor in the market, but the problem is it's very difficult to compete when you don't have any regulatory tools to actually do that. I'll show you in the presentation later, around how you need scale to actually be competitive in this industry. It's one of the industries where scale is actually one of the most important aspects that help you to compete. As I said, when SALSI entered the market, it had no regulatory advantages. It wasn't given a leg up, as you might have expected from a new entrant. It got the same spectrum at the same time. It had the same license conditions for rolling out community service telephones at the time. And unfortunately, when SALSI entered the market, MTN and Vodacom raised this wholesale termination rate, which was quite a difficult thing for SALSI to allow to compete at the time. Number portability was not available. In other words, once people were locked into their cell phone contracts, they couldn't move between networks, so it was very difficult. SALSI's current market share by revenue is between 12 and 13%. MTN and Vodacom hold more than 80% of the market, 17 years after they were launched. So this must not happen to another new entrant. Just very briefly, if you look on the left-hand side of the presentation, that shows you the service revenue share by operator, and then the part on the right shows you the data revenue share by operator. Right. Now, I'll talk to the slide a little bit more in detail, because what I want to show you is if you look at the bottom, that's the time scale. So it says 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017. So you've got the service revenue on the left and the data revenue on the right. Right. Now, what you can see there is the percentage of share by each operator. So the top line is Vodacom, the next line is MTN, then you've got SALSI and Telkom Mobile. Now, what's obvious from this is in the data revenue share, I suppose MTN does take a bit of a dip from 2015, but seems to stabilize in 2016 and 2017. Vodacom in the data revenue has quite a nice jump also around that time. But generally, the lines are pretty flat, right? Now, what does this tell you? It tells you that if you don't do anything different, this is probably the trend that's going to continue. So yes, SALSI and Telkom Mobile will sort of, over the next 5 years, maybe get another 2-3 percentage points, if they're lucky. But the point is that that's not enough. That's not going to change anything. It's quite clear that we need some other intervention in the market that will actually change fundamentally those lines. And we'll explain why you need those lines to change. This is some of my colleagues from Vodacom. I know this is their favorite slide. Obviously, they've seen it before, I think, in two of the other hearings. But this is just to show you the relative imbalance in the financial performance of our companies. What we've tried to do here is do a like-for-like comparison. It's not always easy with different financial year ends, etc. But we have got at the bottom the where the information comes from. But what you can see is there's three sections, right? The first one, which is the blue, the red, and the green, that's all Vodacom. The next in the middle is blue, red, green, MTN, and the next one is SALSI, right? Now, what you see there is that Vodacom's revenue, for example, is multiples of SALSI's. Their EBITDA is more than our revenue, which is saying something, because what it means is that with all these profits that they make, they can continue to have this advantage that they already have in the market. It's very, very difficult to actually pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. So what this also indicates is that as I showed in the previous slide, unless you do something as an intervention, it's highly unlikely that the situation will change. Now, why is this negative for the market? Well, the reason it's negative is that between MTN and Vodacom, as I said, they get 80% of the data market revenue in South Africa. They do compete with the duopoly, but in a very limited way, only to kind of maintain the status quo. You know, high prices are then entrenched in the market. So when we use the word happy in inverted commas, we say, yes, you know, on the face of it, it seems like there's competition between them. Customers do move occasionally between them. But generally, the large operators can match any price cuts that challengers make and make higher profits as well due to their economies of scale. The higher profits, as I said, just keeps going around and entrenches the behavior. So it's highly unlikely, unless something dramatically changes, that they will want to compete in a proper way to drive prices down in South Africa. Cell C and Telkom try to gain market share, but we're hampered by a number of factors. One of them is, for example, there's some negative aspects of the national roaming arrangements that we have. We have lack of access to radio sites, and our network costs are on a per unit basis much higher. So it's not that Cell C is inefficient, but it's just that because we have fewer customers, our efficiency is regarded as less than the dominant operators. And this is not a South African phenomenon, by the way. So what we're saying is cost-cutting measures are not the answer. The solution is to address the entrenched duopoly and the absence of real competition in the market. Scale, as I said, is important. Our costs, again, ICASA have said, are efficiently incurred, and that was why we were in the most recent round of mobile termination rates afforded a level of asymmetry again. What we are saying is that in order to efficient scale is around the 20 to 25% mark, and as you saw there, you know, we're not even at half of that at the moment. I'll briefly go through this slide where what we showed is that Cell C in 2012, for example, introduced serious competition and slashed prices in the voice market. It was well received by the market, but MTN and Vodacom, because of their market power, didn't actually drop their prices. They, for example, have an on-net pricing strategy that meant that it was easier for them to retain the customers on their own network, and customers were reluctant to port out to Cell C or Telkom Mobile. So the duopoly have higher fixed costs from their more extensive network coverage, but because of the number of customers that they have, they're able to distribute these fixed costs over that base, which makes for a lower per unit cost. That's really the point we wanted to make. So moving on to the policy framework, right? Clearly the goal of regulation is to ensure that customers and consumers benefit in the long run, and most importantly, to address markets that can't fix themselves. As I said, it's very difficult for somebody to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. A policy and legal framework, if it sets the right objectives, ensures the regulator has the right tools, monitors implementation, and ensures that scarce resources are distributed fairly, and enables competition, and also, as I said, avoids duplication of overlapping structures, can achieve all of this. Does national policy deal with these matters? SA Connect covers certain of the elements. DTPS, for example, to collaborate, to administer access to land and enable rapid deployment is one of the issues in SA Connect. Spectrum sharing is addressed. open access is introduced, and it does also talk about how demand spectrum being allocated on a fair basis. The white paper, creation of a WOAN, existing, as I said, the DG addressed this. What does that mean, open access? Rapid deployment, also addressed there. It supports investment, and it says high demand spectrum will be available for use by all licensees. So the policy framework says all of the right things, right? I think just getting on to the, let's call it criticisms of the bill that we do have, is, and I think it was addressed by Alf as well, is that we think that some of the aspects in the bill are maybe a little bit unnecessary, that they are already currently provided for in policy, so it wasn't necessary maybe to include some of them in the bill. We have, in our extensive written submission, made this clear. But then there are, so in other words, there are, the ECA in its current form does contain adequate provisions dealing with policy and policy directions, competition, licensing, spectrum management, network rollout, etc. I think, and the reason why a lot of it has been included in the bill is because it's a frustration that a lot of it is not actually getting implemented. And we understand that frustration, especially from industry side. Oh, sorry. The next slide, which I'll also briefly talk through, is these, you may recognize the points where there's 1, 2, 3, 4 above the purple bubble, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 below it. The note that was given to you, or the submission by Eric, the researcher, these are the points that he raised. And the top ones are what he identified in his view as being the problems in the ICT sector. And then the bottom ones are what he said were the root causes. And I think all we were trying to say in this slide is that I'm not initially certain that these have been correctly identified. In other words, the problems and root causes, I don't think are necessarily all you know, that the submission that you received doesn't necessarily address all of these issues. And on the right, we've tried to address some of the answers to why we say so. So does the ECA go far enough in its current form without amendment? We're saying if the ECA is to be amended, it should track national policy goals. The law does not need to repeat national policy, okay? It doesn't need to deal in detail with matters that relate to operations, administration, or implementation. It shouldn't determine matters necessarily that require further investigation because there are socio-economic or financial impacts. And many of the problems that the bill is trying to address in specific terms are actually people problems, not necessarily legal problems. And we think that those legal problems can be solved under the current ECA. So in a nutshell, we're saying that some of the proposed amendments are not necessary and are not legally appropriate to direct policy goals or inadequate. But that's really the only major criticism we have of the bill. Then jumping into the second last, and we are really quite near the end of our presentation, I thought we would address the issue of the WOAN head on. This next slide basically shows you, and I have already addressed the problem, lack of competition, the status quo not addressing, but this is for an example of a slide which shows, and I think you would have seen this in previous submissions, Dr. Gilwald, Professor Gilwald, all of these showing that this is internet penetration as one of the measures, right? It's just not good enough. 45% of South Africans over 15 years do not have access to the internet regularly. What you can see from this is that there's bar graphs on that at the bottom is broken down in per province. So the total is on the left, and the axis on the left also has the percentage of penetration. The different colors The dark blue on the far left is metro. The lighter blue color is urban, which is between metro and rural. The purple color is rural access, and then the black is total, right? Now, obviously, I think it's quite, we would all agree that I think it shows that it's inadequate, but also the pattern is what you would expect in South Africa. So, for example, Gauteng, as the province, the richest province in South Africa, has the best or the most penetration. And then KZN and Western Cape are not far behind. But then the other provinces clearly are very badly lacking. Okay. So, as I've said, SALC is a strong and active advocate of open access infrastructure and service-based competition. SALC is the only current enabler of MVNOs on our network. So for those of you that don't know, an MVNO is a service-based competitor. What they do is they access the infrastructure of the existing operator, and then they offer products and services on top of that. So we've got numerous MVNOs on our network. Some of the more well-known ones are FNB, Connect, and there's also Mr. Price, Virgin Mobile, and we've recently signed a deal with Standard Bank as well. So they, I think, will be launching one of those soon. We also co-founded Fiberco, which is a long-haul fiber player, and this was done on a completely open access basis, a very similar model to what I think we see the WOAN, how that would work. And we also an active user of open access fiber. So what we're saying is that correctly implemented, the WOAN can positively shift the market structure to provide more choice and value for consumers. Service-based competition, efficient network deployments, leasing, swaps, reuse where possible, build where no coverage exists. And there are successful precedents in the SA ICT sector, most notably, for example, Fiberco is an example, but we also have some of the fiber providers as well, where they've just gone ahead and got stuck in, and it's actually been very successful. Some of the key arguments against the WOAN, I've already spoken of some of them. One of them is that it will create a new monopoly. In our construct, and as I understand it, the construct in the bill, the WOAN does get spectrum, but so do other operators. They say there's no international precedent. I think it's early days to say that. There are countries where this is definitely being introduced, and if you haven't already been told, we can make those available. But, I mean, Mexico, Rwanda, there are a few other countries, but it's a new concept that I think is getting a lot of attention. Successful open access network operators in SA and globally, and we're saying, what makes wireless different. So, for example, even the undersea cables, that's another model, not wireless, but it's another open access model. One of the other arguments is that data prices are already falling. Well, yes, they are, but they're still, due to the high level of market concentration and the costs involved in supplying the networks, those prices are unlikely to fall unless there's a catalyst. So, the question we ask, are South African prices really that low? And what can we do to unlock the ability to make them lower? Another argument is existing mobile operators already provide coverage. Well, access to 3G is not ubiquitous, let alone LTE. Although in the metros, there's too much network. There's duplication. And we think that with 5G and the spectrum and the networks that are needed to deliver 5G, this problem will only actually get worse. This slide I'd like to focus on, we really are very close to the end, but one of the points that we would like to make is that we think that the current bill doesn't actually go far enough in regards to the WOAN. And the reason for that is that the Warren needs, in order for the Warren to be successful, it needs certain things, right? So there you can see in our construct, on the right, we've got the Warren receiving Hardeman spectrum and then other operators also being able to access Hardeman spectrum. But our view is that the Warren must receive most of the new Hardeman spectrum that's available, more than 70%, but the other operators can receive, you know, on whatever process that ICASA introduces for the rest. A very critical point is offtake agreements. For this thing to be financeable, you need to have some kind of guaranteed offtake. Now, we're not suggesting that this is done, this is not a charity, it's basically a service that is provided and it's paid for. But all you do is you basically lock in those offtake or key anchor tenants in advance. Infrastructure sharing is a license condition. So in other words, the intention is not for the Warren to now go and build a completely new network across South Africa. What we're saying is that it can use existing infrastructure where possible, and that will drive down costs. Clearly, broad-based black economic empowerment. I've got HDI. We've had the discussion previously this morning around the difference between black people and HDI, but currently the legal position is that HDI is the standard and that the ECA prescribes a minimum of 30%. And what we're saying is that anyone who wants to access spectrum, and including the WAN, needs to comply with that. So for the WAN to be successful, you need a financing structure for equity and debt for it to work. The debt would be secured by the offtake agreements. There must be a cost-plus revenue model, okay, including a reasonable return on capital. This is not, the WAN is not going to be a massive for-profit company. It's similar in our view to the roads and the power companies. So for example, the toll road company gets given access to a toll concession, has to build the road, gets given certain rights for a period, and there are investors that are very prepared to invest in those companies because they can see the stability of the return that they're likely to receive over the period. The Warren must have national coverage, including both urban and rural areas. Sorry, just a final point on this. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll see as well that we've got existing spectrum unchanged for the operators, and I think to commend the department, there was great concern when the first draft came out that there was going to be some kind of nationalisation of spectrum assets, and they clarified this very clearly in the latest version. Because it was just a misconception, I think, in the wording. So there's no intention to take back the existing spectrum. Just wanted to focus a little bit more on the offtake commitments. What we're saying is that currently there's a minimum offtake commitment of 30% for a period of not more than 3 years. And our view is that this is inadequate. In other words, if this was implemented, the Warren would not be successful. And we think that it needs to be substantially more than that, and that anyone who wants to acquire a new spectrum should be required to offtake from the Warren. Also, MNOs and government also need to make some commitments, because then this will help to successfully finance the Warren. The last slide on this is the timing of the spectrum licensing. What we're saying here is that the other spectrum that gets licensed cannot happen, should not happen before the WAN actually secures its financing and becomes operational. This is critical because otherwise it will de-incentivize people to participate and to offtake with the WAN. The last slide, our conclusions and recommendations. The Warren, in order to be successful, will require adequate spectrum to ensure national coverage, adequate offtake, and regulated facility sharing. Broad-based black economic empowerment, should be mandatory for all new spectrum licensees in line with the ECA, which is currently minimum 30%. The Amendment Act should empower ICASA to provide the regulatory incentives that support the success of the WAN. We believe that national roaming, in addition, should be regulated. Spectrum sharing trading should take place under an open and transparent system of regulation. ICASA independently should be allowed to administer spectrum and monitor usage. And rapid deployment, which is an easy one, must be enforceable and adaptable at municipal level to ensure its success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Any addition from Celsi? Mr. McKenzie, sir. Are you all right? You're on the floor. Madam Sheen. Madam Zutetri. We shall proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've been trying to get my head around what the entire sector and the WOAN and duopolies and monopolies, and it just occurred to me that a very similar analogy would be the political environment. Since 1994, we have one dominant player, then we had a second dominant player, that group. So now we have two...
Out of order.
No, Chair, I'm just trying to make a point here. So now we have two dominant players and lots of smaller nyamas going on. Do we then say the advantage of being a big player, you know, access to resources, government, incumbent advantages, do we then say now we must capacitate these smaller players and hamstring the bigger players to enable the smaller players to get more votes? Because ultimately it comes down to voter choice or consumer choice. So that's an analogy that I'm playing with, Chairperson. And I wonder if politicians, if it was so close to home, where we would, our allegiances would lie.
Trying your luck.
Just on to the presentation. Mr. McKinnon, thank you very much for your presentation. Much appreciated. You mentioned the impacts of this bill will have sort of two or three decades hence. I think just in terms of ownership and certainly the focus we've been paying on broad-based black economic empowerment, that in 30 years or 20 years or maybe even 15 years, I think white people will be largely irrelevant in this economy anyway, Chairperson, I think just in terms of growth. So perhaps we should, if we're talking about 30 years hence, perhaps we should consider that. Mr. McKinnon, don't you think in terms of the objectives of this bill, in the absence of this bill, and I think as a committee we're coming to terms with the complexities of this, don't you think that light touch regulation can achieve, certainly in terms of cost to communicate and access, that light touch regulation can accomplish that goal in the meantime, and similar in the allocation of spectrum, that ICASA could in fact achieve many of these objectives through a spectrum auction that has conditions attached to it. Then in terms of the WOAN directly, if, and again I'm not a technical man, if we allocated spectrum to Cell C, Telkom, Vodacom and MTN, the high demand spectrum, they would then add that to their network and roll out whatever enhancements they're making, could it be 5G. If you then allocate that spectrum to a WOAN, doesn't it add an additional cost of doing business onto the MNOs, and wouldn't that in turn drive up the cost to communicate rather than drive down? Then, if I can just turn to your presentation specifically. I won't be long. Just two more questions, Chair. On the profitable duopoly and market failure persists, you said the on-net pricing strategy of MTN and Vodacom has meant that consumers remain with their current provider rather than porting out in the hopes of benefiting from on-net promotions and cheaper prices. What research have you based that conclusion on? And then one more, Chairperson.
On your timing of spectrum licensing, you said the release of spectrum to other operators must therefore be simultaneous with the WOAN actually securing its financing and becoming operational. In the hearings before this committee, there seems to be a figure or a number around 5 years that it will take to get the WOAN really up and running. Are you then suggesting that high demand spectrum, which I see all the industry salivating over, drooling and drooling, getting access to this, if we were to wait 5 years before rolling out access to high demand spectrum, won't that take us back as a country, hold back the telecommunications sector, and stop us getting the benefits from the release of the spectrum? Thank you, Chairperson.
Madam Shin.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. McKinnon, did I hear you correctly saying that the WOAN will be a not-for-profit company? If so, on what do you base that? And then my question would be, why on earth would anyone invest in it if they weren't going to be making any profit out of it? I mean, why are they going into business? So I want you to please explain that to me. It's the first time I've heard it's a not-for-profit company. Then do you believe that South Africa's economic population footprint can actually support a fifth network company, a wholesale network company? Because, you know, we've had presentations that have shown that in most of the sort of more densely populated, more economically profitable countries, that 2 to 3 wholesalers are all that that can absorb. Would it not rather be an idea that companies like yourself, the smaller ones, and MTN, Telkom, Mobile, get together with the people who actually want to get the WOAN concept, if you like, and join together? I mean, would you actually consider that the sort of consortium of the smaller mobiles get together with the WOAN, the people who are here to be the WOAN beneficiaries, join together to make it a third bigger competitor to MTN and Vodacom? Is that an idea that's being discussed at all? Because, you know, I just think having five network companies might not be sustainable, particularly as rolling out the infrastructure to the places that need it, which is rural, and getting LTE out there, is going to be quite a considerable investment. And from what I understand, the WOAN people won't be using their own individual money, but trying to go to government entities, which are, so they have to get at the end of the queue from SAA and Eskom and all the others to get their money out of the IDC, I mean the PIC. So to me, there's going to be financial uncertainty about it if they actually want to be serious competitors in the infrastructure space. So I'm just wondering if there isn't some other sort of merger that can happen for a WOAN to actually be in competition. Also, the obvious idea that we've been just batting back and forth all week is the proposal that the two main networks split their operations into retail and wholesale. Do you believe that's a good idea? Would that make it more easier for yourselves, let's just say if you stayed standalone, to be more competitive in the market? Thank you.
Madam Skins.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm looking for some other PVC, but I don't see them. I'm missing my notes. But in other areas, it's like the department or the minister is somehow interfering. I just want to caution the fact that the minister of the department, as a public representative, if there's any kind of competition that is harmful to other small players, they'll definitely intervene, consider the legislation that is there. And I think in other areas, there will be a need for the intervention of the Competition Commission to make sure that the playing fields are leveled. And there's an area whereby it is mentioned that Cell C has been in competition 17 years before Vodacom. I just want to get some clarity as to how did it happen that there's this huge gap after, you know, that 17 years of being senior to them in terms of operation. Is there any kind of maybe unfair competitive advantage that made them to be where they are? Thank you.
Thank you. I guess colleagues have raised the important questions. And perhaps for me, just is really to round it off. You made the point that the first two players had a regulatory advantage that they had over yourselves, and I think it's almost something that my colleague was speaking to. So if that is the case, what are you saying about it? What do you think was supposed to have happened or can happen? The second matter has to do with the amount of spectrum that you are recommending to be allocated for one, for it to be viable, and the timeline you referred to, the years to which they have been allocated. What is your recommendation? Can someone attend to this thing? I guess those. And perhaps if you can also then help us with. You did speak to the international experience. You referred to the two countries, but you said you think there are more that you could avail. Even if you don't do it now, we'll still appreciate if you give us more. Now, and the last matter that I would like to raise is really almost a question that was raised by Madam Shin. He asked the question as to, do you think a fifth operator would be viable in an economy of like South Africa, for instance? And the question that I would like to ask, which is almost a related question, is what are the figures that makes an entity viable? Now, let's take South Africa and its economic situation. Let's take another country. Taking the metrics of both your economic strength, your incomes, and whatever you vis-a-vis the rollout of connectivity, and just perhaps a comparative analysis as to what you think would work or could work better. What are the things that we should consider as legislators in making the one viable, or any other participant in the economy viable? I think that kind of question, if you are able to help us, it would possibly help. And I don't know whether there is any other participant other than the department that would want to come in. Ikasa, you fine? Department, are you okay at the back? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think it was a very clear presentation, so there's a little more clarity that I can add from the bill. However, perhaps on the 30% not being enough, and especially on a three-year basis. So we are revisiting the wording in the proposed policy direction, and the two periods may not be the most appropriate solution, the one being the three-year period. We're also likely to move from the individual capacity procurement to collective capacity by specifying a minimum of perhaps 30%, but ICASA may prescribe a higher percentage in those circumstances. The period also being reconsidered based on submissions we've received, and we're likely to specify a minimum period, leaving discretion to ICASA to make it longer. Mm-hmm. But the important part is that it should be able to secure takeoff. That's critical in that discussion, in the interest of the success of the WAN intervention. Chair, the bill, as said earlier in this week, will be amended accordingly to the, at least in the version we then proposed back after further consultation to Parliament, to the extent that it is then overtaken by the developments under the policy direction. I picked up the specific recommendation on the need for national roaming regulation. I think we couldn't agree more. The current mobile data wholesale market review may help in this regard, but more specific to the bill, we believe that the open access framework and its classification of deemed entities following due processes as built into by the bill will enable active infrastructure sharing and so national roaming in due course. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, let me start with a very conceptual question to ponder. In a world of regulation or in market economics, when is good good and bad bad? At what point do you know that it's good or bad? What measures do you use to arrive at certain conclusions? Now, there was a period when it was said that which we have, is good, is fine, that's all we have. But until the interventions of the American system into AT&T in the early 1980s, and later on the breakup of British telecoms, we got to know that certain interventions will always be required to change and not destroy markets. So it's a complex discussion perhaps to have as to at what point you can say that this market is good, we can't do anything to it. So even at the conceptual level, it's very difficult to arrive at some agreements. Now, what actually, there is a point that CELSI makes around regulating for the future. Now, the big question is, what is this future? The future that CELSI refers to, I wish to believe, is about the digital economy, where it is said that by 2025, there will be more machines that speak to each other than there will be human beings that could speak to each other. So there are about 7 billion of us, I don't know how many are online, that communicate with each other. So by that period, it's said that there will be more machines that speak to each other than us. Now, for those machines to do so, they will be enabled by this sector that we are dealing with ourselves. So it means that practically a large chunk of the economy will be subsumed by this sector, will be based on this sector. Meaning that the market that we create is not just for WhatsApp and please call me, but we're now beginning to create a market where substantively the whole economy will be based on that market. Now, if we create structures because of today's exigencies and not foresee that future, that in fact for us to operate in a digital economy, we will need the kind of an environment that the department is proposing. Now you can live without being online, but when you move to the digital economy, practically everything will be based on the platform that we control as those of us who are seated here. So that is at the heart, at the crux of this discourse around tinkering with the market so that it can support the digital economy. We don't believe that the current market structures will do exactly that. Chair, there's always been a question of a WAN being a monopoly. Well, at the elementary level, obviously, a monopoly will mean a single
provider, and we have since moved away from that arrangement, that understanding, which was in the white paper. Now, having said that, is it true that the introduction of the WON will destroy investments? To the best of my knowledge, from reading what has been submitted, that has not been substantiated. It will, of course, change the market structure, but it has not been. It will not lead to destroying the destruction of investment, because the WON itself is an investment. And we attempted 2 days ago to argue that. Our understanding is that the WON is going to be formed by people who are practitioners in the industry, who have capacity to go and raise funding. So there would be an invitation to apply that would ask for technical capacity, business plan, and ability to raise funding to be licensed to operate the wireless open access network. And that will be an investment as far as we understand. So it's not clear how the WON will destroy investment when itself is supposed to be an investment. So I think that maybe we will explore that as we move on. Just lastly, Chair, also on whether a creation of a wholesale open access regime will reduce investment in the sector. I think that requires even a deeper discussion. Maybe it does not belong to this platform. When we go back with industry, we'll have to look at that, because there are clearly different views on what it means to have a wholesale open access regime. You know, it may not mean what is said to what is being characterized in the discussions that we have listened to here, but we'll follow up on those details, Chairperson. Thank you.
Mr. McKenzie? I think the bigger question we should have asked is whether, as we move forward to this future that is being planted, whether we will have borders, boundaries, whether we can actually speak of boundaries of countries when people become less important, the machine speaks to each other. Those people don't vote. They have no territorial respect. Perhaps that's what you should be saying. How are we going to legislate for the future? Now we're grappling with something that may not last. And perhaps that's what the players should be telling us. As we enact this legislation, what is the lifetime of what we are doing? Perhaps we're spending a lot of time for something that's going to last for a few years, and it becomes relevant because machines would have taken over. And some people have started marrying machines, eh? So... No, I'm not about to. I want a heart. I want warmth. I want the hugging and stuff. Yes, I am, sir. Can I get back to selfie?
I'll try and answer the questions, and my colleagues will as well. So if we miss some of them, please, we'll get to them. The one question was, in the absence of this legislation, isn't light touch regulation preferable, and couldn't we just do an auction and sort of get on with our lives? Well, I think we've addressed that at a high level where normally, yes, I think light touch regulation is the best approach. However, clearly where there's market failure and concern for future market structure, I think you do need a more important intervention. And certainly, in our view, this is exactly the situation that calls for that type of intervention. The other question was, if we allocated the spectrum simply to the MNOs, does it add additional cost? Well, our view is, I don't think it's going to be as simple as simply saying to the existing MNOs, here's each your little piece of spectrum. What we've tried to explain is that the normal construct in these decisions is it becomes a financial issue. So the big guys with all the money end up being the ones that ultimately or typically succeed in auctions. In our view, it does possibly add to the cost because then you will carry on having, you know, four or more operators competing on an infrastructure basis. So our view is that the aggregation of the network infrastructure is what will actually be the catalyst to drive down these costs.
With your indulgence, that actually wasn't the question I was asking. I was saying, will the WOAN add to the cost of doing business? Because I presume for the MNOs to access that high demand spectrum in the WOAN, it's going to cost them some money to do so, rather than if they just were allocated spectrum directly. Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Actually, I see my notes now. I don't think so, because what we're saying is the aggregation of the network in the WOAN will actually result in a lower cost than as opposed to that infrastructure being duplicated. I mean, I think the question suggests that you would have a network operator with a network that is duplicated by the WOAN, and that's not how we see this thing working. We see the WOAN being the network with regards to this spectrum that it provides, and that the mobile operators would offtake from the WOAN. Therefore, it shouldn't add an additional cost. It would just really be a substitution. You know, they would have to build their own network to get the equivalent service. With regards to the on-net pricing, yes, we actually did do extensive research on this issue. And in fact, and we're happy to share that, we submitted a comprehensive complaint to the Competition Commission in 2013. We had reams of economic data. I can't recall, but it was something like 15 lever arch files that supported our complaint. And I think they did read it, and to be honest, and with all due respect, I think it was actually so complicated that it took a long time, and you know, the Competition Commission they also had a resource constraint, and they eventually, after 4 years, said that they weren't going to pursue it. But it's definitely an issue. They didn't say that. Correct me, Karen. They said that there is an issue, and that they referred it to ICASA to look at. In France, for example, the operators were actually fined for this very conduct that was happening in South Africa, on-net, off-net price discrimination. And basically, I won't bore you with the detail, but what it does is you create these clubs where it becomes obviously better to stay on the network. So, if you'd like, we do have extensive, in fact, I can send you the complaint that would, you've got nothing better to read, but it is definitely a phenomenon, and it is still a challenge. In terms of spectrum and the timing, okay, I mean, I think we'd all agree that if it was going to take 5 years, that would be too long. We've done quite a lot of analysis on this, and our view is that it would be anything from 18 months to 2 years that we would actually be looking at, which is a more realistic time frame. You know, I think that's really, and if you look at the challenges faced with the 700 and 800 spectrum, for example, it's not an unreasonable time frame with the digital dividend, etc. So I think that's kind of more our thinking, and we're happy to share the work that we've done on that. Regarding the points of a not-for-profit company, apologies if I use those words. That's not what I meant. I meant that the intention would be for this company not to get the type of returns that telcos typically get. So if you look at the slide that I put up earlier around the relative EBITDAs and the revenues that the companies earn, I mean, there you're looking at EBITDA margins of north of 30%. Now, what we're saying is those are typically very sexy telco-type returns, and we don't see this in the same light. We see this more as a type of company that would invest in a much more stable, for example, like a toll road operator or whatever. They don't get anything like the returns that telcos typically receive, but there are clearly investors who are prepared to invest in those companies because there's an obvious and stable return that they are guaranteed. So I think that's really where we're coming from on that. Can South Africa and the market support a fifth network company? I think in our view, this is maybe a slight misconception of how we see the WOAN working. We certainly don't see it as being you have, you know, four or five operators and then you have another operator coming in that is just competing with them. So I certainly think, in our view, the intention would be for the WOAN to be allocated the spectrum and then for it to go and seek infrastructure sharing from all of the other operators so that it wouldn't duplicate infrastructure. That's exactly the point. Where necessary, it would maybe have to build infrastructure, but it would effectively be aggregating the infrastructure, not duplicating it. So I don't think the fifth network concept is actually the correct way of looking at this. In addition, sorry, I know that you talked about the WOAN having to go and stand in line as with the other SOEs. It is not intended to be a SOE. It's the construct is that it's a private company. Okay. Yes, I see what you're saying, yeah. But as I said, I don't know if I've answered the question, but it's certainly not that this is going to be another network operator with another network that just goes around trying to get consumers as its customers. On the question of the gap between Cell C and the others, why? So just to address that question, I'll explain why. But I think one of the main reasons we raise that in our presentation is what we're trying to say is that this happened to Cell C, and we're trying to say, please don't let it happen to the WOAN. Don't hamper the WOAN by not giving it the necessary regulatory support that it would need as a new entrant to be successful. So very briefly, when Vodacom and MTN entered the market, for example, in 1994-95, they, remember at the time, Telkom was the only telco in South Africa. And what they managed to agree with government and Telkom at the time was what they called an asymmetrical interconnection regime. So in other words, when somebody called from Vodacom or MTN to Telkom, what happens is the network operators actually charge each other a fee for when the call goes from the one network to the other network. And what they managed to negotiate was a massive asymmetrical advantage where they could charge more when a Telkom person phoned Vodacom and MTN. They could charge Telkom a lot more than what Telkom was allowed to charge them. Now, it sounds like quite an arbitrary concept, but what it means is that on every single call, there's a massive revenue that you earn from your competitor. And that interconnection advantage helped MTN and Vodacom to actually fund their network infrastructure rollout when they started. Now, they also obviously had the only licenses and they were able to sign up all the contract customers that were available to be signed up at the time. When Cell C entered the market and, you know, the investors at the time probably should have negotiated a better deal, they didn't. But that's just the reality of it. In 2001, they had no advantage. So in other words, they were given a license, and they said, go, run, build a network, do what you have to do. As soon as they came into the market, MTN and Vodacom put up the interconnection rate that Cell C had to pay to MTN and Vodacom. So it put them at a massive disadvantage, and there was no regulatory assistance that Cell C could rely on to actually stop that practice. So it really never got going properly. And unfortunately, we're a lot better now. We've managed to at least, eke out a relatively, in the circumstances, decent market share. But it's not enough. And that's really why we're saying this disadvantage persists even now, 17 years later. So, for example, ICASA in the wholesale termination regulations actually did introduce asymmetry to try and assist not just SALSI but the smaller operators. And those kind of interventions are what are necessary to help new entrants and small operators. And that's why we're saying for the one to be successful, you do need these things. On the recommendation of how much spectrum, Temba, do you want to address that? My colleague, Superior Board.
Thanks, Akram. So, Chairperson, on the aspects of what could be recommended for the WAN, perhaps the first introductory remark is to say that you have to be committed to a market reform, because this licensing of the WAN, we should see it as the phase that would have happened in 2001 when Vodacom and MTN were being licensed. And the idea is that you cannot have a piecemeal commitment to this policy. Otherwise, the WAN will just fail just like the users. And so we are concerned about the prerequisites for the business case of the WAN. In other words, it must have adequate spectrum given to it. It is being licensed in a 5G world. So that means infrastructure aggregation is actually happening anyway. And its licensing is not in the 2G or 3G world, as it were. Now, there has to be empowering provisions in the law that allows for ICASA to give regulatory support to the WAN. The second aspect, which I think is important, is already outlined in the bill, is the open access regime, because open access means that the WAN would enter into agreements with the existing infrastructure for purposes of redundancy in the network and to facilitate the efficient utilization of the spectrum awarded to the WAN. So those are key recommendations which we see in with respect to regulations. But those regulations have to be provisions that empowers ICASA. And therefore, as I see it, it is not possible to avoid amending the Act in order to give effect to those, even if the policy directive process were to proceed. Thanks,
Do you want to answer the question on what figure would be required to make it successful? Sorry.
Yeah, So, a WAN, we take note of the CSIR report that was commissioned by the minister. And to respond to this, we commissioned a study to model scenarios on how an effective WAN could be successful here. And the Analysis Mason report, which is in your pack, Chair, gives us a sense that the WAN anticipated to have a 20% market share is not effectively competitive and therefore cannot achieve national coverage. It's not actually a viable business case. And with respect to spectrum, a 40% market share of a WAN takes almost 70% of the spectrum currently available. And on a high road scenario, a WAN with 8% market share utilizes most of the spectrum that is currently available. And that means in the future identified bands for 5G, more spectrum will have to be given to the WAN. So we have to have this mindset of understanding the technology licensing, although it's a technology neutral licensing, but we are moving into the 5G world, and which is already imminent. So, with respect to market share, on slide 15, we indicate that a minimum efficient scale of 25% in a 20 to 25% in a 3G world would give you sufficient scale benefit. So, in the 5G world, probably this scale benefit is much more than what we indicate here. Thank you.
Mr. McKenzie?
Thank you, Chair. Just one small question. Mr. McKinnon, can you give me a very high-level overview of your ownership structure? Thank you, Chair.
High-level, yes, I can. We are 40%. We have Blue Label owns 45% of Solsi. Net One owns 15%, and effectively management and staff through various structures own the balance of 40%.
Are we fine? But I guess when we conclude, and thank you very much, Chelsea, for your inputs, your research work that you had conducted and shared with us, responding to the questions. I assume, sir, ICASA is taking the issues that are being raised serious, because it does appear that the playing field has not been quite level, and we cannot continue to have those kind of unleveled situations. They have a propensity to tilt our landscape against the envisioned empowerment or the process of transformation. So those things, I think, have been dealt with. I just wanted to conclude by saying because I can see now the big bosses are coming in. We have said, because I don't know how long others will be staying and leaving, but we are advocating for, whilst we have the opening between now and the election time, when Mr. McKenzie was talking about how things should be shaping up, that the ANC must shed some fat and give to the next one. The opposite actually is going to happen. We will be going up, 2/3 majority and above and so on. That wasn't a lighter note though. We request that during that intervening period when Parliament will prorogue, members going to canvass, coming back, that in preparation for the new committee and the new Parliament, engagements between the department and the industry players should actually occur, so that the next Parliament is assisted with a toned down or finding each other approach in terms of where we stand with regards to the bill, and see how we could actually achieve the objectives as envisaging the bill, without really having to, where industry can think almost without singing from the same hymn page, but I think taking into account the ultimate objective, that is ensuring that the 50-odd million end users are actually the beneficiaries of whatever we do. The reduction of cost of communication, of cost to communicate, the whole issue of ensuring empowerment, so that we actually have a well-leveled system where people are benefiting from this future that we are continuing to embrace. I think in short, that's what I would like to say as I adjourn the meeting for 45 minutes until 2 o'clock for members to have lunch, and everyone is invited.